Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Newbury Court, a full-service retirement community in Concord, Massachusetts. Newbury Court is committed to creating active, independent lifestyles for persons 62 and over. More at newburycourt.org.
And New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
I'm Jim Brady, head on Boston Public Radio. Mobile sports betting is in full swing here in Massachusetts, heightened by March Madness, a barrage of non-stop celebrity-endorsed ads, and those bonus betting dollars. Kicking things off, we'll open the phone and text lines at 877-301-8970 to get your thoughts. Are you getting swept up in the betting fever, worried about problem gambling on the rise, or are you sick of all the betting ads?
I'm Marjorie Egan. If sports betting isn't your thing, maybe you'd be more interested in blowing $2,500 on on-demand, AI-powered, full-body scans. Nirvana for the hypochondriac. Jim, of course, has already signed up. We'll get Art Kaplan's thoughts on that and on an overhaul for the country's organ transplant system. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hi. Friday, we're at the library, you know.
We're at the library on Friday.
Who's going to be there also?
I don't know.
The Attorney General.
Oh, thank you.
11-12, ask the Attorney General.
You're always way ahead of me, Jim.
Campbell.
You're planning ahead.
Well, I'm trying
I'm living
to do
in the
my
moment.
Best. Yeah, well, that's a beautiful thing, actually. You may be happier that way. So, speaking of the moment, online sports betting started in Massachusetts this month. It feels like it was about years ago. And if you don't know that, you must be living under a rock, because we have been subjected to endless ads, and they are absolutely everywhere.
Sportsbooks now live in Massachusetts.
Big news! DraftKings Sportsbook is coming to Massachusetts.
You'll be so dialed into every play that you forget to eat your wings.
Jamie Foxx, what's up, my man?
What up, Barry? Got time to chat bets?
Yeah.
FanDuel makes it so easy to get started.
And you can get paid instantly. That's like the whole point of winning.
By the way, around Jamie Foxx there was Kevin Hart, and obviously the last void was Gronkowski. So are enticements like that $200 bonus betting dollars once you place your first $5 bet in the various apps bringing you into the fold? As Dan Shaughnessy wrote in The Globe the other day, and he nailed it.
Another great
They're selling
column.
An inflated sense of wealth and happiness. Here's a quote from Dan's piece. Everybody's happy, surrounded by young, attractive friends, soaking up suds and making cash without actually working. They hug, they high-five, they do cartwheels in the man cave.
Yeah.
So are you concerned?
And he went on to say it's like grooming.
Grooming, exactly. Yeah. It is like grooming. It's a perfect word. Are you concerned about the slide for some from occasional gambler to potentially an addict? Are you concerned about the slide from non-gambler to gambler, or are you simply all in? Are you one of the, I think it's almost 500,000 people who've already set up online accounts here in Massachusetts? The number is 877-301-8970. You know that I'm an anti-state sponsored gambling thing, so I'm against it all.
Yep,
I'm against the lottery. I'm against all of it. And because it mostly preys on lower income people, and it leaves you with the notion you're going to win. And obviously, if you're going to win, the state wouldn't be doing it. The only way, for example, in the lottery, the state can give $1 billion to cities and towns, because people have to lose $1 billion for it to go to cities and towns. Same with this online gambling here. And the fact that it is not limited by the legislature in some fashion, whether it's social media, radio, TV, it is absolutely everywhere. And, you know, I'll give you an example. For those who say we're overreacting, Trenny Casey, is she a fairly grown-up kind of person?
Well, just one second. We have known Trenny Casey for a long time.
Long time, yeah.
When she used to be Trenny Kuznarek before she got married.
Well, that was her?
We had her on the show for quite some time.
We have.
To say she was, like, really ecstatic about her newfound life as a gambler yesterday.
Talking faster. Did you notice that?
So go ahead and tell
her. Here she
what
is. She said, this is with yesterday. The library.
Yep.
As Trenny, obviously, from NBC Sports Boston. She's sharing her experience with mobile sports betting since it became legal in Massachusetts. Here's just a drop of her thing yesterday.
the evolution of Trenny as a gambler in the last week and a half
this is what I'm talking
has
about.
Been very fast. But I haven't placed a bet in a couple of days.
Wait a second. What's the $200?
It's been a couple of days.
It's been a couple of days. Exactly. She caught herself after she said it. And let me just say, for whatever it's worth, yeah. I am not a – I don't gamble. And incidentally, it is not because I'm a purist. I'm a purist around state involvement. It's just because it hasn't been easy. Now that it is this easy, you can do it on your phone. And oh, my God, I'm getting those $200 bonus, which we'll talk about in a minute, I think. I've been very close to signing up for this thing. And I think I'm not typical.
I mean,
I'm Trenny, essentially.
You're Trenny, or you're like this guy, Jay Friedland, who is by Spencer Buell in the Globe piece. I think it's from today, who says he's from Somerville. Says he's not much of a gambler, lives by the maxim that you shouldn't bet money you don't have. But he said when legal sports betting went mobile this month, the 31-year-old accountant saw what the online apps were offering. A typically wary Friedland found himself intrigued, at least slightly. He talked about the advertisements popping up in Davis Square, on the MBTA, every social media site. All these different companies are involved here. Barstool, BetMGM, Caesars, WinBet, DraftKings, FanDuel. And he said the thing that really caught his attention was the so-called no-brainer, where you bet that promised to double your wages of up to $50 if the Celtics scored a single point. And, of course, that's ridiculous because, of course, they're going to score a single point unless everybody drops dead, as the story says, before the tip-off. And, of course, then you get your money.
And you get drawn in whole point. They're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. And, by the way, you know what it feels to me? It feels icky, just like I felt icky when all the casinos open and you're driving on 93 and you see this giant brown accordion, the Encore Casino, a couple of feet off to the side. It's just, in any case, it is here. It is here big time. As we said to you, we read this in the Globe, I guess maybe a week or so after it was initiated. We already, in typical fashion, because we spend more in lottery by far than any state per capita, any state in the United States of America, they looked at comparable size states like Virginia and Maryland, where they also started online betting. Our level of betting was roughly twice as intense as residents of those states. This is a gambling kind of state. And the state is giving people more opportunity to lose their money. 877-301-8970. You even seem upset. Are you upset about this? I didn't even know you cared.
I was watching basketball, you know, the March Madness over the weekend, and I thought, wow, you know, we're really drowning in these ads. It did seem kind of like overkill to me. And to Chauncey's credit, he points out that the ads are all over BostonGlobe.com and Boston.com. Let's start with Rhonda in Providence. What do you think, Rhonda?
Hey, Rhonda.
This has me really upset. I cannot tell you. As a person of color, this reminds me of the cigarette ads and the liquor ads that you would find in the inner city back in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's almost predatory because all these spokespeople are black men, which I don't understand. Like, there has to be some underlying motive here that it just has me completely gobsmacked. I can't believe that this is happening.
Do you hear anybody talking about this? I mean, I
what do you mean any people talking about?
Well, the people you hang around with, Rhonda, I mean, your friends. I've heard a lot of people talking about the just tsunami of ads, especially during March Madness this weekend. They just can't believe all these enticements and ads. So I'm just wondering if it's something that people are talking about in your neck of the woods.
In my circles, yes.
Yeah.
We have spoken about it. And even when I talk to other people, when the ad comes on and I'm in the company of other people, it's almost like they don't see it, some of them. It's so obvious to me.
Yeah.
And it's a deluge.
By the way,
everywhere.
It's as obvious to me as it is to you, but obviously we are in a very small minority, Rhonda, because people love it. We're really glad you called to start things off. Thank you. 877-301-8970. 8970.
So Dan Shaughnessy went and talked to Upton Bell. We've known him. He's been involved with sports around here as a broadcaster. He's a great guy.
General manager of the Patriots.
That's
a long
right.
time ago.
And his father was the NFL commissioner for years.
Oh, sure. Burt Bell, yeah.
Anyway, he talked about how his father discovered a betting scandal way back between the Bears and the Giants in football in 1946. And he talked about how he was able to stop it. But here's Upton Bell. What you are seeing is a complete sellout of all the leagues now for the sake of money. They've turned 180 degrees on everything they said for decades. You couldn't even mention a point spread or odds on any NFL network. And now that's all you hear. It's disgusting.
Yeah, I love Upton Bell, by the way. But to say, oh, my God, they're doing everything they can for the sake of money. You mean as opposed to prior to betting, when they weren't doing everything for the sake of money?
Well, he goes on to say, what are they going to do now when some lineman who's not making $1 million is approached by his cousin? Missing one or two blocks can change a game. And how
well, did you see
know?
Also, in a lot of states where there's online gambling initiated, athletes and their families are asking for greater protection because there's fear that they're going to be threatened if it turns out someone puts big money on it. But the point is, the betting is happening anyway. It's just the notion that the state is going to get involved, essentially paving the way for these nonstop ads for people in Massachusetts. And I know they were going to other states if they could to gamble. I know all that kind of stuff. I understand we're losing money to other states and that sort of thing. But the reality is we are paving the way for people in most cases, in my estimation, for people to lose money they can't afford.
Here's Joshua in Dorchester. I'm tired of seeing sports betting ads on Reddit. It's taking up my entire feed. Please make it stop. It hurts. Please make it stop. It hurts.
877-301-897. And again, we know I'm in the minority. So we're welcoming all comers, including the 500,000 of you in Massachusetts who have set up online accounts in just the last few weeks. Hey, Pat Worcester, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make an observation. In my experience, I'm 60. In my experience, the amount of advertising that you see for anything is proportional to the amount of money that they're going to make and off of these ads. So it indicates to me that whoever's running these games, and that's what they are, it's games, and whoever's making the money off of this expects to make a ton of money off of these
ads. You think so?
Yeah, otherwise, yeah, I think so. And, you know, I just don't understand why people can't read into that. I think I don't know if it's our education system or people just getting dumber. But if you walk into Foxwoods and you look around at all the how beautiful it is and how expensive everything is and any of these casinos, where do they think this money comes from? It comes out of your pocket. And there's so many better things you can lose your money on, like giving to a charity or helping a little league in your neighborhood or, you know, give it to your neighbor that's struggling. You know, it's like
Pat, let me tell you. Pat, what people will say to you is what they've said to me. This is voluntary. People choose, instead of giving to their little league in their neighborhood, as Pat from Worcester suggests, they choose with their own money to bet on the Patriots or to bet on the whatever. What do you say to those people?
Well, I think they're lacking a basic understanding of the science of gambling.
These exactly.
These people that run gambling are borderline neuroscientists, and they probably hire neuroscientists to tell them how to get these people to feed them their money. It's the oldest trick in the book. I can't believe that we're still even talking about it. And it's just these people target people for their release of endorphins or whatever the
exactly
hell.
Exactly right. It's like a dopamine rush.
You
Pat
sound like
brilliant.
A neuroscientist.
I love
Pat.
This guy.
Thank
Pat, thanks
much.
For the call.
Thank you very much for the call. Okay, here's the other side of the coin. Gordon from Brighton. I don't condone sports betting because it's predatory. However, with the free promos, I turned $10 into $350. When I told my roommate I happened to have a medical bill to that amount, he laughed and said that's the most Massachusetts thing he's ever heard of. And here's Carol from Cape Cod. I'm all set with betting. My friends have asked me if I'm gambling, and I always have to remind them, I only gamble with men, not with money.
But I'm bummed. Thank you very much, Carol. 877-301-897. 8970 is the number here. And by the way, the polling showed, I just want to be as fair as we can here, the polling showed before the bill went to Charlie Baker's desk to be signed. It's been before the legislature for years. The majority of people in Massachusetts support this thing. They got exactly what we wanted. We are the outliers. Pat, Marjorie, I are the Shaughnessy, clearly, are the outliers on this thing. So we'll hear from some of the others. Sammy and Melrose, what's up?
Hey, guys. I called, actually, when you first started talking about this on January 31st.
Yeah.
I was basically saying that, you know, you can, well, at least from my perspective, you know, like if you do your research, you can make some money with it. But my question is basically this, and it's for Jim. So I know you don't like the ads, and I agree they're annoying. And I know, you know, the companies are very predatory. I agree with that. But what is your solution? Because it, just from how I understand this is some things are part of human nature. Like you're not going to stop a certain amount of people from wanting to wage war.
I agree.
Stuff.
I agree. But
so
Sammy,
like basically, yeah,
I have a one word answer to your question.
Yes.
Trenny. That is the answer to your question. Trenny Casey, who was with us yesterday, wasn't gambling until it was made as easy as it was. By the way, I am talk about hypocrisy. I am this close to doing it too. You get 200 free bonus bet dollars to bet, even though it's not quite the cash that it's made sound to be. So there, while it is true that a ton of people, and I think this is your point, Sammy, correct me if I'm wrong, who are gambling anyway, and at least let's capture that money and have some tax dollars, et cetera. For those people, you're right, but I assume you have to agree that the brilliance of the ads is a lot of trennies of the world and possibly me of the world are going to start gambling who weren't gambling before. Is that a fair statement?
Well, basically what I'd say is this. You're not going to stop people from wanting to do this.
Well,
I think with the state involved, that's the best you're going to get with it. Because at least with the state involved, there's a lot of gambling ads. But at the end of every gambling ad, there's if this is becoming a problem for you, here's a number you can call. And I think
Sammy, you were doing great till then. Really, at the end of the ad, call the if you have a problem with gambling, call the number. I mean, you really think that's working?
Well, I think it's helpful for some people who realize
if you have a problem,
Trenny will be calling soon.
Oh, that's not funny. I'm sorry, Sammy. Continue. Go ahead.
All I'm saying is I don't see, since you're not going to stop people from wanting to wager on stuff,
yep.
I don't see how you can have a better solution than having the state involved, having everything above board, because even though you might not like the ads, and I don't either, it's better to be doing it when everything is above board than to go down to your local
How about this, Sammy? Wait, can I say something, please?
I'm with you on this, Sammy. You know why? Because you're not. It's the same thing with the war on drugs. How long have we been fighting the war on drugs? If people want to do drugs, they're going to do drugs. And if we legalize drugs, you wouldn't have all these cartels running around. You wouldn't have all these people going to jail.
There's a big difference, Marjorie. The evidence is where drugs, like in Portugal, where all drugs have been legalized, more people are not using drugs than were before.
Because they are getting better treatment.
However, the evidence here is more people gamble when it's easier to gamble and it's closer to you.
But the difference is problem drug use and problem gambling.
Okay, but how about this? Let me make a compromise
to
you and Sammy. Here's the compromise.
Problem gamblers.
Okay, it's legal. How about the legislature saying that you can only spend X dollars on ads? So that essentially they're not enticing us 24/7, people who otherwise were not gambling to all of a sudden. Could you settle for that, Sammy? It'd be above board, but limited advertising. Could you live with that?
Yeah, I feel that's a good point. But what I want to say is I hear your passion, but I think your real passion isn't against wagering. It's against predatory companies. And it's against gambling addiction. That's where your real...
No, it's also against the fact, and I only know the data from lottery, that a family in Chelsea, this is old data, but a family in Chelsea where the average income at the time was $13,000 a year was betting somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 times more in the lottery than a family in Weston where the income was $250,000 a year.
The people in Weston are not desperate for money.
Exactly.
And the family in Chelsea, because we don't pay people living wages because rents are too high.
Do the people in Chelsea increase their incomes with their gambling on the lottery?
No, but they're not. But they're not going to increase their income any other way. So this gives them, this is like a hopeful pie in the sky. Why do you think they do? Why do you think
they're
going to
lose? By definition, that's what you do when you gamble. You lose, or there wouldn't be gaming companies.
Somebody wins. Maybe I could be the person that wins.
Sammy, thanks. It was a great call. We really appreciate it.
I mean, really, what's the difference between gambling addiction and drug addiction? I don't think there is one, despite what you said about Portugal.
Well, I'm not crazy about either of them, actually. I feel the same way about both.
That's the problem. It's like alcoholism. But you can't treat all these things like everybody's going to become an addict, Jim. Most people are never going to become addicts.
Except you can limit the predatory nature of the industry, which, do you support limitation of advertising? You're not in favor of that either.
Well, I don't
know. Free market theater,
I'll have to think about it because I'm sure there's something wrong with it since you just suggested it. And you want to run everybody's lives. That's what you want to do. You want to tell everybody what to
do,
Jim. Yes, you do. Okay, we're going to keep taking your calls and text at 877-301-8970. Do you want Jim Browdy telling you what to do? Or do you want
got a call. Trini hasn't shown up for work. If anyone knows what gambling parlor she's at, could you call NBC
Only
Sports Boston?
Kidding. We're kidding. 877-301-8970 is the number. Are you listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH?
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're at the library, as always, on Friday. And this Friday, the Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, will be with us for Ask the Attorney General from 11 to 12. You're just tuning in. We're talking about online sports betting, which just started in Massachusetts this month. It seems like it's been a lot longer than that. The incessant barrage of ads, these massive sort of bonus betting dollar offers. And we're asking if you're doubling down in your opposition like me, or if you are all in like I think the majority of people in Massachusetts. Give us a buzz or a text at 877-301-8970.
A few quick texts.
Yep.
Bonus money to entice betting is no different from offering an Eton crank radio to entice a WGBH pledge. Then Bilbo in Malden says, Pete Rose is somewhere yelling at the top of his lungs, WTF. Of course, he got in trouble for gambling on baseball, the great baseball player Pete Rose.
Kept out of the Hall of Fame for it.
Here's Betsy in Nashua. I don't gamble. Instead, I started investing in sports betting stocks in the companies that offer the gambling.
That's a good one.
What a low life I am, cashing in on the bad habits of others. Whoops.
That is a really good one. Lindsay in Marlboro, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm going to sign up as soon as we get off the phone because you guys keep talking about it.
That's right. We're part of the problem,
excellent.
Lindsay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm an ex-gambler, bartender, and used to live in Vegas, too.
So
thank you guys for setting me up with FanDuel and that stuff as soon as we get off the phone.
Okay.
So what do you think of this? Yeah, did you say you're an ex-gambler?
So I can't go into bars that have Keno. So yeah. If my friends bring me out, we have to be careful because I'm like, does that place have Keno? Because if there's cash in my wallet, I have to play my numbers. So yes, ex-gambler as in I don't go to the casinos anymore and I do a good job. But if you bring me to one, I'm probably not going to sleep that night and I'll be at the poker table. Mm.
So Lindsay, how did you manage to, is it just staying away or did you go to Gamblers Anonymous or how did you manage to get this reasonably under control?
I moved to Vegas, and it was just so readily available, to be completely honest. It was there all the time, and I just got kind of sick of it.
Huh.
Jesus, that's
really
sort of surprising.
And how did your finances go? Did you lose a lot?
I mean, you know, as a gambler, I broke even, obviously. that's a joke for gamblers. But, I mean, I had some big wins and some big losses. But, I mean, I kind of paid my way through photography school with it, but as soon as I moved to Vegas, it was just there all the time. I worked in the casinos, and it wasn't that much fun anymore.
So one last thing. What do you think about legalizing gambling in Massachusetts? Do you think we made a big mistake?
Online gambling.
The online gambling. I mean, honestly, I work in a bar, so, like, bars are everywhere you go.
Yeah.
So and even, like, that guy I thought was really funny with the you guys always asking, I really want that crank radio, and I'm going to sign up next time. I just always,
it's great, you know, by the way.
I always miss that day.
It's really great.
I'm like, oh, shoot, I missed the crank radio. I have to wait for the next time. Honestly, like, we all have our vices, and you're going to find a way to do it. And I literally have been at this bar that I work at, and 7 of my customers every day, Lindsay, please sign up and give them my name so I can get an extra $50.
Oh, that's right. If you refer somebody.
Yeah.
Hey, Lindsay, that was a great call. Yeah. Thank you for doing it. By the way, in terms of, I should be clear because when I added the word online to what Lindsay was saying there.
Right.
I'm not crazy about gambling where you have to go to the 7-Eleven to buy your lottery ticket or go to Encore.
Phone or on your computer.
This is sitting in your underwear on your couch
24/7. This is from Sue, who says, I don't like gambling, but I do March Madness pool, golf pools, football squares at local pub. A few times a year, fun with other participants. When I do football squares, I don't like to know numbers until after the game. I usually lose, but it's fun. But, she says, I feel online gambling could be much more addictive.
Because it's there. It's there available all the time. By the way, when you have an urge, I mean, one of the things when I'm on a diet, which is like, what, a third of the year, I'm on a diet, what I try to do is keep foods that I know that are a problem for me out of reach. Because you know why? Because I have to go down the street to get them as opposed to the refrigerator. As someone who has an issue with food for most of my life, that's the way you try to deal with it. Here, if you have an issue or don't even know you have an issue yet because you haven't gambled before, it is literally in your face all the time. And I just think that is a – I mean, obviously, it's great for these gambling institutions. I just think it's not – if you really want to do it, why don't you go to a damn casino, which is what the law was originally and then obviously expanded a month later. Well, in the same law, but the implementation expanded a month later.
Ellen in the car, what do you think?
Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I don't know how I'm going to come off, maybe kind of like a school mom, but I just feel like there's so much emphasis on just money, money, money. And now we're making just sports, which we thought were kind of like man against man, you know, racer against racer, you know, skier against skier. It's now it's kind of like suspect. And it's kind of like, can we do one thing in our society that isn't so suspect and isn't so like,
no, the
you
answer
know,
is
did that
no,
guy Ellen. Wear the pink sock? No, and it's really sad. It's like, did the guy wear, because you're literally betting on, will he turn to the right? Will he turn to the left? It's like, it just seems so bad.
You know, Ellen,
And now it's in your living room.
You know, not only,
like, can't we just have one thing?
You don't sound like a school marm. You sound terrific, and thank you for the call. Ellen made a point that I'm embarrassed to say we have not made in any of our discussions about gambling for people who don't gamble.
Uh-huh.
You can bet on everything.
You can.
You could bet on this at the Super Bowl, for example. Do you know what you could bet on? How long it would take for the national anthem to be sung. No, how long whoever was singing the national anthem would sing the national, everything. There are
who's
these prop
the
bets.
Off.
Exactly. Yeah. Everything.
Yeah.
Things that are purely luck, things that take some skill. You can now bet on the Academy Awards. Well, obviously you can't for this year anymore. But there's, once it's opened up, we're making it sound like it's only a sports betting kind of thing. Who's going to win this game? That's the absolutely smallest tip of the proverbial losing iceberg. Matt and Newton, hey.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having this program.
Thank you.
I wanted to respond to the point Marjorie made about gambling addiction being analogous to drug addiction and the way the war on drugs is waged and the way drug treatment can be carried out. I was just tweeting about this as well for your program.
Everybody Matt, we only have about a minute, a little bit over a minute left, so you're going to be quick. I apologize.
Sorry, Marjorie.
That's okay.
I think you're right, Marjorie, that drug addiction is a good analogy, but gambling addiction can't be treated. The programs to treat drug addiction that have worked involve building personal relationships with addicts, with people. With online gambling, that's just not going to be possible. And with so much money to be made from gambling, I don't see how we're going to put in place the programs to treat people's addictions to gambling. We certainly haven't done it with drugs, like Portugal or other countries have done. And I just despair to see how many people's lives are going to be ruined and worsened by this.
Well, I'm not crazy about gambling. I'm not sure I subscribe to your notion that treatment is bound to be unsuccessful. But we'll get into that, too. Matt, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
I just want to say that I said before how you want to run everybody's life.
Yeah.
Well, Bilbo from Malden just emailed
Bilbo
back.
Bilbo is the person's name?
He just texted back rather to say that he wants you to tell him what to do. So I'm going to give you his number. and you can call him.
That's one person.
How to organize
in
his
that
life
category
going forward.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay. We are done with this for now. Anyway, I'm sure we'll revisit as we see how online gambling plays out in Massachusetts. But right now, are you, like Jim Browdy, on the wait list to get a full body scan powered by artificial intelligence because you have a hypochondria problem? Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us on that and more. He's next. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie Regan, and I'm Jim Browdy. It's a hypochondriac's dream come true. A company has plans to set up shop in Massachusetts offering full body scans, no doctor's note required, and they're even powered by AI. What could go wrong? Actually, I'll let you know what could go wrong after my appointment this afternoon. Joining us to discuss is medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Art is a doctor's William F. and Virginia Cottling Mini Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
So, Art Kaplan, before we get to Jim's artificial intelligence appointments, and maybe you can help him out picking the right place to go, some big breaking news in an area that you spent a lot of time working on, organ transplants. There's this proposal to basically overhaul the way the whole operation works, breaking up a kind of a monopoly. What's happening?
Well, for a long time, the federal government has given a contract to an organization called the United Network for Organ Sharing, based out of Richmond, Virginia, to distribute organs, Marjorie. They basically get the list from all the hospitals, say Mass General or Brigham or NYU, that have people waiting for kidneys and hearts and livers. They also keep an eye on organ procurement from people who die. There are about 50 regions around the country that each have their own organization that is responsible for going to hospitals and asking families. So that sounds all fine, but the system has gotten stale. It really does need an overhaul. I'm not sure this country needs 50 organ procurement organizations anymore. That was from a time 30 years ago when you couldn't ship, or, you know, we all see these pictures. They get the cooler, they're headed to the jet, they're moving organs all over the place. Better technology basically means you're not taking someone who died in Needham and transplanting them at UMass Worcester. You don't have to do it that way anymore. You can give it to the neediest or the most likely to succeed. So that should be reformed. And I think this whole system for distribution has gotten a bit stale too. Over time, people have weighted heavily who needs the organs the most, who's going to die the soonest. But that was when organ transplant didn't work very well, more experimental. So you felt like, well, we gave it to Jim, but Jim was going to die anyway, and we killed him, so not so bad because we gave him a chance at life. Now they work better. You know, transplants, heart transplant, you'd be expected to get 10 years of life. So we need to get, if you will, the maximum number of lives saved. And so those shifts in thinking, I think, are very important. The system is old, and it needs upgrading. And I support the calls for change.
Two quick questions. One, what level of government involvement is there at all in the whole transplant world?
So it's, as everything in the U.S., it's complicated because states run organ donation laws. They decide who can be an organ donor and all that. The feds run the distribution of the organs, but each individual transplant center gets to decide whether they're going to take you as a patient. So think of it as a funnel. If I want an organ transplant, I get seen at NYU. They can say, I'll take you or I won't take you, depending upon my health condition, whether I'm a prisoner, whether I'm a drug addict, blah, 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 blah. If they take me and I get on their list, then I go to the national list and that's run by the feds. Does that make sense?
So it's
a two-step process.
Well, I don't know if it makes sense. I mean, I understand it now. One last question. I know we asked you this years ago when Kevin Spacey was the president on television and he jumped the line for whatever organ it was. Is there line jumping or is there not line jumping?
Probably for presidents, there's going to be line jumping. Short of that, I don't think there's a whole lot of line jumping.
Good.
There is something else that comes into play.
What's that?
The cost of these transplants can be pretty high. Heart transplant, liver transplant, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, at NYU, we did a face, probably millions of dollars to do that. The ability to pay matters. That's how you can jump the line.
By the way, before you leave here, every time we do an event for like board people here or whatever, people ask what the difference is between GBH and commercial radio. And we say we love commercial radio. And what the story we always tell, the first interview we did in our new job here 10 years and maybe a month ago was a guy by the name of Bowden Pomahawk, who you've probably heard of, who did virtually all of the face transplants, which was one of the most glorious experiences in our early public radio lives.
By the way, you notice there hasn't been much news lately about face transplants. It's because they're so expensive, almost nobody can afford them. That's what's going on.
You know, I have one last question. I wonder if human beings are all basically the same, your heart can go to anybody, or if there are differences, man to woman, African-American to white, Asian, you know.
Yeah, there are differences. There are differences, and they count. Blood type matters. You can't take a sort of B positive and put it into an A negative person. And their antibodies, they do tend to cluster around racial, ethnic groups. Not 100%. You still have to test. But you do. You want to make sure that you're matching the blood type and the immune system of the donor and the recipient. What we try to do, Marjorie, what they try to do, I'm so tied into the NYU thing, I got it as we. What they try to do is to pour in a lot of immunosuppression to overcome the differences.
Okay.
So your best donor is if you have a twin.
Oh,
They're ideal. That's what you want.
Okay, so let's get back to what Jim is really concerned about. How soon you can get one of these AI body scans for $2,499, which probably aren't going to find anything, but they may find something tiny, which would send you into a downward spiral quickly. What do you think about these?
It's a very negative attitude, Marjorie.
These are for-profit companies.
I can report on where Jim needs to move and get a new job immediately, and that's Southern California. I think you guys may remember I was out there to do some talks at different schools a couple weeks ago. Every parking lot along the Pacific Coast Highway, Newport Beach, Santa Barbara, has a mobile body scanner. You don't even have to go into the hospital. You just walk into these things, flip out your $2,500, and they'll start radiating you, you know, at the beach. It's like, it's out of control. So I'm not a fan. I'm just not a fan of this. I don't think we have agreed upon standards for who should run these machines. Are the technicians properly trained? Do we have good counseling about what to do when they find something? And by the way, Jim will be happy about this too. They will find something because everybody's got weirdo anomalies. Right. And what tends to happen is they'll say, well, we found a little 1 centimeter mass that was on your lung, and we don't know what the heck it is. It's probably nothing, but you should talk about it with your doctor. You go to your doctor, and the doctor says, I don't know. There's a lot of people with bumps and stuff all over them, and I'm not sure. So I would say best bet, if you really care about this sort of thing, just get a physical, you know, from a good doc, and that's a good checkup. And then instead of worrying about all your radiated innards that you want to tell everybody about what you see in pictures, we're back to the old, how about signing up for the gym? How about signing up to lose weight? Those are better investments of $2,500 than the scan.
I have a physical scheduled too, so I'm covered. You know, there's a great term, which I've never heard before, but I'm sure you have. In the piece we read about this AI MRI, they refer to it as for the worried well. Which is really great.
Yes.
But wait, one more thing here about the
and
whole.
And by the way, the discoveries of those oddball things are called incidentalomas.
Oh, that's great line. But
wait,
one thing here about AI, we talk about AI in so many different contexts almost every day on the show these days. Well, as a preventive thing, AI, particularly if you're asymptomatic, as I suggest, you're suggesting is not the way to go. In terms of reading scans and things, it would seem to me that AI could be, I don't know what stage of development is, a huge, huge advance. Am I?
Yeah, it will be. It's just getting hyped too much now. I mean, it's perfect for this sort of thing because it can read a scan more quickly than a human. It probably has better, if you will, precision than the human eyeball in trying to read scans. It can mass a lot of information more quickly. But you got to work all that out and coordinate it to say, oh, we did 2,000 scans and the robot or the algorithm said 10 people were sick, but in fact, 20 people were sick, so it's missing something. All that work hasn't been done yet. What we got is a lot of hype. People are sort of like, AI, and it's going to be in the parking lot, and you're worried, and come on in. Better to do this than suddenly drop dead of something.
But you know, Art Kaplan, I'm always suspicious, and this is anecdotal, but I've heard this many times. Women get ovarian cancer by the time they realize they have it. It's too late to do anything about it. I'm very suspicious that medicine isn't more rigorous in testing for this. And I really don't believe that. I think it has to do with money is what I think it has to do with. I could be wrong. But you could see where somebody who's had this in their family, who's gone through a tragedy with this,
Fair point, Marjorie. If you were at risk in a risk group, a relative had something, let's say ovarian or whatever. And by the way, I'm not sure how well these body scans are even detecting that. By the time it's detected, it's usually bad.
Oh.
Wait, I'm not sure it can detect early onset of, I don't know. I'm just telling you, it may not be a good predictor or a good forecaster if you're going to get in trouble here. But whatever that may be, the reality still remains, as you scan around and worry about these things, it is good to have early warnings and all that sort of stuff. I'm still going to argue, unless you're in a high-risk group, you're better off spending your money on other health interventions for yourself.
Hey, Art, can we do one more futuristic thing before we get back to current events? Is George Church, who we've discussed with you before, maybe the smartest person on the planet, a scientist at involved in the CRISPR stuff and everything else that requires huge brains in Cambridge here, is involved in this effort where they're suggesting they're pretty close to growing human eggs in a lab. I guess a couple of questions. How close are they? And two, I'm assuming this is an ethicist delight if there ever was something, yes?
I am secretly sending money to George Church to fund that project. We love the idea of modifying cells into either sperm or eggs. And how close are they? Pretty close. So why would you care? Well, there are some people who just don't make sperm or eggs, but they still would like to have a biological child. So one way to do it is to modify, say, a skin cell or some other cell and turn it into your sperm or your egg. So it does have a place in medicine, and I think
so. A same-sex couple could have a biological kid. Yeah,
correct.
Okay,
correct.
Or people who are, past menopause.
I'm not sure.
I want to do that, but I
can. No, they could, and also just people who don't. There are men who are sterile; they don't make viable sperm. Yeah. You could turn in some of these cells. So that's all great. The other step, however, before we start seeing it set up these things next to the body scanners, the make your cells into sperm mobile units. We do have to test this a lot in animals. Obviously, you want to make sure whatever gets made really does produce healthy kids. The challenge there is you're not going to really be sure they're healthy until the kid gets to 10.
Yeah.
Well, so again, it's one of these experiments to the delight of ethicists where you can't really cinch up the risk and the benefit until you see how the kids do for a while.
But isn't the potential here? I mean, you said they're fairly close in all likelihood at the beginning of this.
Mm-hmm.
This is yet another incredibly important area where the ethics and regulations are going to trail by a mile the science. Are they not?
Well, they will. And also because of Dobbs and the abortion decision, some of these things may require some experiments on human embryos to see how they grow and so on. Some states are not going to let that happen because they're going to say these are little tiny people and you're going to destroy them, not use them. You're just studying them. So no research like that in our state.
So wait a second. So just one last question, just so I understand, you know, from the skin thing. So when Bruce Springsteen was singing Monday Night at the Garden, he would occasionally walk into the crowd, hold hands with people in the...
And take off his shirt,
I hear. He did. Well, he ripped open his shirt, which is... but he was mocking himself, actually, as an old man. It was pretty cool, actually. That was a great moment. So you're holding his hand, you scrape his forearm and take a little skin. I mean this seriously.
Yep. Yep.
You can create something out of somebody without their consent, obviously,
correct.
Right?
And in theory, you could clone
baby Bruce.
A person without even
right,
having
exactly.
to do anything. So, yes, those... that's why I've been arguing for a long time. The basic principle, I think, in law should be no one can be procreated without their explicit consent.
Yeah, I think that'd probably be a good thing. We're talking to Art Kaplan.
So, Art Kaplan, considering that more than a million people have died from COVID-19, this story from the New York Times is pretty upsetting about how...
A million in the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah. That scientists, excuse me, at the Centers for Disease Control and the CDC itself knew that asymptomatic people were spreading COVID, but they didn't tell the public because the Trump administration didn't want them to. That's essentially what the story
says.
It's
so horrible on so many fronts. First, it's a distinct reminder of how terrible the Trump administration and Trump were in engaging COVID. Initially, remember, it was gone by the summer, drink bleach, not so bad, it's just going to stay in China, blah, 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 blah. They fell way behind in getting masks and protective gear out there for people. These inside people knew what was going on and I think had to act more loudly. You know,
so do I.
We were making comments back then, I don't know if listeners remember, about Deborah Birx, and they kept saying, why isn't she quitting? Why isn't she just sitting there with a scarf and smiling at him when he talks about...
Because she was in love with Donald Trump. That's why she didn't
probably
quit.
But we need to have more moral integrity. And I know it's jobs, and I know it's careers. I get all that. But you can't sit there in the middle of an epidemic watching mismanagement, lying, baloney, flying out of the White House, and not save lives. I'm sure we could have saved many lives with an earlier response.
You know, I'm going to ask you a question. Only half is really for you. Another half is for Judge Nancy Gertner, who I think is joining us tomorrow. First of all, yeah, another example of this, which people will remember. Remember when that Nancy Messonnier, I think her name was,
yes,
a month
CDC.
Before the pandemic was declared? She was a big shot, not the boss at the CDC, said we're about to have a pandemic, and she was reprimanded for that.
Yes.
But here's the question. For... If you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that something horrible is going to happen and you're in the healthcare field, you're a public health person at the CDC,
right.
There are two questions. The one for you is, do you not have an ethical responsibility, even if it means you lose your job, to speak publicly? And I have to say, this is the issue I'm going to, and maybe it's ridiculous to ask Judge Gertner tomorrow, is how is this not a crime? If you know that it is likely a lot of people are going to suffer and die, just like how did Trump not commit crimes? Is it fair to say hundreds of thousands of people or the millions didn't have to die if he was not a homicidal president when it comes to COVID? How
is
there not?
Yes, and by the way, maybe even Mario Cuomo, who never addressed the nursing home outbreak in New York.
Andrew Cuomo. Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah. And
but so how about the ethical obligation?
Yes,
there were a bunch of them.
We want to create a duty. We want to have an obligation. And what we try to do is build in whistleblower laws and ask the judge.
That's a great idea.
Aren't they protected under, it's used in other contexts. Wouldn't it be relevant here? And if it isn't, then let's extend the law like yesterday, because we need to rely on the experts to tell us the truth. I don't really care what Donald Trump and his administration think about COVID. They're talking out of their hat. They don't, they're not the experts on that. They treat it politically.
Well, what I think is interesting about this story, this wasn't just one physician, it was several, and how they knew about this and they were agonizing over it.
Yeah.
And one is actually quoted, one of the trainees is saying, all of us knew tens of thousands were going to die and we were helpless to stop it, but
they were not helpless.
They were not helpless to stop it.
I think I wrote 10,000 Twitter messages saying, will the Surgeon General please resign? Will the Surgeon General please resign?
We talked about it a lot on the show. Yeah.
Yep. And it was, you know, it became evident that there was a gap, shall we say, between what the experts were seeing and knew and worried about and the politics of silencing them and going off in cuckoo directions. So I think there was mismanagement. I wish we would have a national commission, nonpartisan, that would take a look back at all this and sort of, you know, make amends. We're not any better to deal with the next pandemic. Politics is still driving the boat.
Hey, Art, before you go.
And by the way, on politics still driving the boat, let me just say again, I said it last week, I'll say it this week. Wuhan lab versus origin of the disease from bats or pangolins or
raccoon dogs, which I never even heard of.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
I don't care. Fix both. It's pure politics to keep fighting this out because they want to blame China on one side. And that's irrelevant. We got to be ready for both.
China or Fauci on the other side. So before you go, first of all, this is a spoiler alert, which we rarely give on the show because we want you to listen every minute. Last episode of Last of Us, which was a huge success, there's this ethical dilemma that is sort of historic. Vox calls on one of the premier medical ethicists in America. But they didn't answer the phone, so they called you. No, I'm going to say they called Art Kaplan on the phone. I love this. Again, if you don't want to hear about the last episode, turn off your radio for about 90 seconds. Explain what the dilemma – explain the whole thing. I love this story.
So in the show, they're suffering from a horrible pandemic that's been killing everybody for 20 years except a few people who managed to stay away. The thing is a mushroom-borne disease that the spores come out and they get in your brain and kill you, basically. But one young woman apparently is immune. So the proposal is to take her, force her into an experiment that probably will kill her and find an antidote that can then be given maybe by vaccine
chills,
or whatever
yeah.
to everybody else. So the ethical dilemma is, could we kill Art to save the world, basically.
It's the trolley thing that we've all heard about, right?
It's the trolley problem. It's also the prohibition in our research ethics now that you can't kill somebody even to benefit a lot of other people because that is the way the rules are. So what I said was, look, if it was up today in front of a research board and it was the start of the pandemic, say COVID, you couldn't kill somebody in the name of getting a cure. It wouldn't get through. 20 years of mass deaths, civilization teetering on the end. Yeah, I think the numbers start to count. And I think, now they didn't do it in the show, but you could give the woman the chance to volunteer to do this. What they were going to do in the show is just take her unwittingly and kill her. What I think you'd have to do is say, you'll be a hero, you'll be an altruist. You could even offer rewards to her next of kin and that sort of thing. But I'm going to tell you, I think in the trolley problem, 20 years out, yeah, that experiment gets done.
That's great. It was great. It was great. Your response was great, and it was a really interesting thing, and now people can turn on their radios again. Art Kaplan, it's been a pleasure as always. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Art.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with medical ethicist Art Kaplan. He's the Dr. William F. and Virginia Comley Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Coming up, our national security expert, Juliette Kayyem. She's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. Law enforcement officials seem to be preparing for the worst in Manhattan, where the DA is supposedly close to indicting Trump on charges relating to those hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. If it happens, will Trump be treated like any other criminal defendant? We'll get the thoughts from national security expert Juliette Kayyem. Then Roger Berkowitz is back. He's the man who built Legal Seafoods. He has a new online venture in Roger's Fish Company. He'll join us to discuss, and we'll try the food.
I'm Marjorie Egan. A new local startup is taking aim at the annoying process of returning clothes you bought online but then don't like. We'll talk about it with Shirley Young, business columnist for the Boston Globe. And Lunchables is offering a meager alternative for kids' lunches. It's raising the eyebrows of parents and nutritionists alike. We'll talk about it chat with food and policy expert Corby Kummer. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. We're at the library on Friday.
Yes, we are at the library on Friday. It's going to be a great show. Really great show. Really
Who's
great
there again?
Show.
I'm sorry.
Really great show.
Who's with us?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. We've had this
discussion. Attorney General.
Attorney General. Thank you. Ask the Attorney General, 11 to 12. Joining us now, though, is national security expert Juliette Kayyem. Juliette was an assistant secretary for Homeland Security under President Barack Obama. Marjorie and she were just discussing important issues like what she was wearing on CNN last night.
Very
She's
important.
She's now faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Hey, Juliette.
Hey, how are you both?
We're great
to be in studio.
It's
great
to
be
in
studio.
It's
a beautiful day.
It's great to be in studio. So, Juliette Kayyem, I read this story in the Texas Tribune. It was focusing
so
on the Uvalde school shooting where 19 kids and two teachers were gunned down with an AR-15. And there's been a lot of post-reporting about how all these cops were outside and did nothing for more than an hour. And some of them had AR-15s.
The best reporting by CNN, by the way.
Oh, he was relentless.
Yes. He's been fabulous.
Yeah. He was relentless. But anyway, it turns out that the cops in this situation and in some other situations, including the Pulse nightclub massacre and the Marjorie Stoneham High School in
Florida.
Parkland, Florida. Thank you very much. Same thing.
Yeah.
Police officers were afraid to go in, not because of the shooter, but because of the weapon.
Weapon, right. I mean, the shooter with the weapon, right.
Which makes it kind of all about the weapon.
The weapon again, right. So, and there's a reason why most responsible police departments, police chiefs, and the major police law enforcement agencies or, you know, consortiums are all for assault rifle bans and getting these things off the street. It is them that are, you know, asked to run into the room. They are trained to run into the room. I'm not excusing their behavior. But nonetheless, it raises an important variable, which is if there's weaponry that that armed police officers are afraid to encounter, why are we putting our children, why are we making our children susceptible to it? There's a dialogue in it that's disclosed in the Texas Tribune speech where you hear, I can be bleeped, but I'll bleep myself. You know, you hear one police officer say, you know, it's a automatic weapon. And then one says, oh, F.
Yeah.
It's an AR. And that's all he says. He says it's an AR. Like, you don't have to say anything else. And then you hear someone else say it's an AR, like as if, you know, it's an alien or something, you know, but it's not. It's something that we authorize to get out onto the street. So this should tell us something about the kind of society that we have allowed to fester at this stage, which
is... Can I say more about this? I'm really glad you started with this. This investigation by the Texas Tribune, they say, based on police body cameras, emergency communications, interviews with investigators, etc. And even though some of the cops in Uvalde had the same weapon, the AR-15.
Yeah, they had it
too. They decided to wait for the Border Patrol SWAT team people who are 60 miles away.
Yeah.
Here's a quote from the school district police chief who disgraced himself, Pete Arredondo. We're going to get scrutinized for why we didn't go in there. I know the firepower he had based on what shells I saw, the holes in the walls in the room. Next is the preservation of life. Talk about an irony. He says everything around the gunman was a priority. Obviously not the preservation of life of the kids. But the point of this, which to me screams off the page, it's no longer the rhetorical representation by responsible gun control advocates saying it's the weapon. It's the weapon. Mm-hmm. That's what we got to deal with. The cops here, as Marjorie said, here in Parkland, in Orlando, all say it was because of the kind of weapon the shooter had that we acted like we acted most irresponsibly in Uvalde.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it won't stop any of these pathetic people who are owned by the gun lobby. It totally undercuts any of their arguments that it's about mental health. It's not about the weapon. It is about the damn weapon.
And it has, I mean, this... I hadn't put it together before, but you'll remember we had a conversation about my thinking and sort of, you know, because I do monitor these things and I am well aware of them about the sort of, you know, my rethinking about run, hide, fight,
right.
because of the weaponry that's out there. You simply cannot wait for law enforcement. It's not simply because law enforcement might be a minute or two away, but it's because law enforcement is now afraid of this thing
exactly
on
right.
the street. And so I think that's like very important to remember, that the transformation that's occurring and sort of how we deal with active shooter cases is could be more easily solved if we just got a certain weaponry off the streets, or try to. I mean, that's the thing. Just try to, so that we can give time. That's all we want. Is all we need is time. We're not going to stop every bad person from trying to do a mass shooting. You just want to give a little bit more time to the poor people who are in the room, and for law enforcement to get there adequately and successfully.
One of the things the story pointed out in a really gruesome and graphic way is what it means to be hit by a bullet from one of these AR-15s. And they talk about how the bullet twists and turns inside the body. It doesn't go straight through the body like other bullets do. So when they were testing these guns, they said, and they tested them, apparently the M16 that they talked about in Vietnam, this is kind of a variation on that, that at a range of 50 meters, when one man was shot in the head, his entire head looked like it exploded. A second man was hit in the chest, and then in the back where the bullet exited was just this massive hole.
So imagine all these kids and these
guys. The kids were unidentifiable.
But no one, and I would not do this without someone's permission, someone's going to have some courage here to say, just like Emmett Till's mother did, and said, I want the world to see what they did to my son. Somebody's going to do that, because if you see what 6 and 7 year olds or 9 or 10 year olds look like, and these congressmen are still going to defend these guns. You could have people up in the gallery with these pictures, like they do outside abortion clinics, you know, with what these children look
like. No, I'm against the sanitizing of this. It's funny you say that. I'm very torn about that piece just for a variety of reasons. But the way we even use language is so sanitizing to what in fact is happening to these people. I mean, they're being exploded. I mean, the way that they are being, it is like having
like
a grenade go off inside yourself, like swallowing a grenade. And imagine a child, the children in Uvalde were not recognizable. That gun tore through a 5-year-old's, you know, body.
Remember, they asked them, what was your child wearing?
Yeah, what was
when
your child?
He or she went to school this morning, because they couldn't identify them.
And remember how the Texas governor responded, not by any legislation to control gun use, but by sending DNA kits to all public school parents so that the kid could be identified.
So when their child was exploded, God help us.
Can I end, though, on the note that I want to take away from this, and all the points you both are making, obviously are huge. Every single reporter or anchor who has the opportunity to question someone in Congress or a lobbyist who's against banning AR-15s, for example, has an obligation to read the quotes from these people from this investigation and say, okay, you just told me that guns aren't the problem. Here's the head of the cops in Uvalde, 400 of them waiting while these kids are murdered for a SWAT team to come from 60 miles away. What do you say to that? Let every single damn one of these accommodators answer that question.
If people want to look
at Texas Tribune.
He has a battle rifle. Police feared Uvalde gunman's AR-15 by the Texas Tribune.
Yeah.
It's a really great piece of journalism and very, very upsetting.
Texas Tribune is a kind of incredible paper.
Yep.
I guess I don't even know where it's out of, and I should. Shame on me.
I think,
So, Juliet, turning to the everyday world of Trump fiascos.
Oh, my gosh.
We've been saying for 3 weeks now that the indictment is imminent. I don't know if this indictment is ever even going to happen, but what is the latest?
So the latest is, I'm looking up right now, that Manhattan grand jury will not meet today.
I guess it's not imminent today.
Or it's done, and that there's going to be that is going to finalize. So let's just go back a week because I missed you guys last week. Donald Trump ends the week saying the indictment, or I'm getting arrested, or the indictment's coming on Tuesday. That was made up. No one knows where he got that from. I have a belief that he picked a date that he knew it wouldn't be so that he could say, look, they don't have the goods, as if it all ends because he says it ends. But it sounds like they are pretty serious about this indictment. This is of the, you know, of the 20.2 million cases against Donald Trump. This is, for everyone should know by now, the Stormy Daniels one. It's not just because he had sex with a porn star, nor that he paid her off. Either of those things are fine, fine in the sense of we won't put you in jail. Everyone can have their own behavior. But the thing that wasn't fine was, of course, the use of campaign expenditures and the hiding of them to pay her off, because
saying I was just sending money to Michael Cohen,
right, or to his false name, legal fee, and then there was a false name. And I mean, the interesting thing is just how I want everyone to sort of just criminal or not criminal, the man is on the precipice of becoming president. Presumably, if we believe him, he can afford this payoff out of his own pocket. No one will notice. And yet he doesn't want to spend it. So he does this subterfuge. And this is the thing that got him in trouble. This makes me think that he did not think he would win, that he was preserving his own personal finances and was like, I'm going to spend the campaign finances now because I'm never going to run again because, you know, I lost. So this is what we're waiting for. I've been working or talking a lot and writing a lot about the security aspects of it. And there's just two pieces that are worth considering. One is just sort of, I do view this as an opportunity for the Secret Service to redeem itself. We all know that of the madness that the Secret Service was both contributing to and then a victim of during the Trump administration. He milked them. He abused them. He politicized them. They were willing to be politicized, all of those things. This is an opportunity to move the body, as we say, the corpus, from point A to point B and back without any drama. I think it's an opportunity for them to say, our boss is no longer this guy. He's just a protectee. Win his protection. He is just a protectee. The President Biden is now the president. I think the more interesting.
Stay on that for a second. Yeah. Your piece you wrote in The Atlantic I found pretty interesting. Yeah. Is your position is they are there purely to protect him, and the cops are in charge. Yeah. They're not there. Apparently, Trump wants to do a perp walk so that he can both
raise $1 million, $1 billion,
drum up the protests and that sort of thing. And the point you were making, which I think is a wonderfully valid one, is the Secret Service should not be dictating or even recommending anything. They should be receiving information so they can do their job and keep a former president safe. End of discussion,
period.
Right?
And it's easy. You're just moving the body and not to make get into the legal, constitutional, political, historical aspects of it. They get back to logistics because we should not be talking about the Secret Service as much as we have over the last couple years. I think the more interesting and probably more relevant to listeners aspect of this is that this is a moment of which Donald Trump is trying to galvanize support. He's, on Saturday, or he posts about going out to protest, about taking America back. These are languages. This is the language of January 6th. And for people like me who've been monitoring the violent movement, not MAGAism, nor even his popularity, which is still incredibly high, but just the concern someone like me has about violence as an extension of his political power. I'm not ready to say it's over. I am ready to say that this week will mark the beginning of the end of that piece of Donald Trump's success.
Why do you say that?
Because he can't deliver. He just cannot.
Well, except he's getting help. Here is
Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson, right? Yeah. And while he mentions the Department of Justice, I assume he just misspoke. He meant any prosecution. Mm-hmm. Here's thoughts on violence as a reaction to any Trump indictment. Yeah. Carlson, here he is.
What happens when the Department of Justice decides that his goal is not justice, but protecting the ruling class at all costs? Think about that. People are still going to demand justice. The desire for justice is an inherent human desire. We are born with it. But if there's no neutral place to do it, some people will decide they're going to have to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Now, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but we can say for certain it's going to be really.
You know what's incredible? Beyond the fact that they, no way, beyond the fact that they don't care at all about our democracy or violence, the fact that these people are in the midst of a lawsuit.
I know.
For $1.6 billion about lying and knowing they were lying.
Yeah.
About the election results. This is the Dominion suit we've talked about a lot. We'll talk at great depth with Judge Gertner, Nancy Gertner, tomorrow. And doing this here, it's almost like no lessons learned. The fact that, I guess Murdoch's too busy with his fourth marriage, but whatever it is.
Did he get married again?
No, fifth marriage.
Did he get married again?
He's about to.
It's his fifth one. Yeah. She's some 60-year-old.
Model.
No, she's not a model.
She was a model.
She was a model. Okay. Yeah. He's 92.
Jerry Hall,
He's really happy, though. He's really happy.
Yeah. He said, this is going to be the last one.
I shouldn't have brought Wally.
I know, because you got both of us distracted. Forget the violence. What?
I should look it up. I think it's the fifth marriage.
Okay. But I'm sorry to keep pressing this. What's the evidence? I hope you're right.
I am right. Anecdotally, I feel this way.
What do you know? I hate saying I am right.
I want people to separate. Okay, there's three, there's three pools of things I'm worried about. Or three pools of activity that are undemocratic. Okay, so the first is the jerks on cable and Twitter who are saying things and being cute and coy and Tucker and all that stuff. So that's allowed, unfortunately, allowed to do it. We know what they mean. The second is the one-offs, the people who will listen to someone like Tucker and worry and do something. Those people still exist. I think there's probably not as many of them as there once was, but those people still exist. The third piece, which I worry about, is a political movement that embraces violence as a means of winning and will be able to deliver on that. That I'm not seeing. And that makes me happy because in the world of less bad, which is the world I live in, that is the piece that has scared me for two years.
What would you be saying?
I would see rallies. I would see people out in the streets. Okay. I would see Mar-a-Lago busy. I would see New York busy. I would see the kind of activity online that I saw before January 6th. I would see that now. Okay. This is how crazy. The arrest obviously helped. But if you look online, right, there's two narratives, and they are not "we love Trump." The first is he betrayed us because they all believed that they would be doing January 6th and get pardon.
Right.
The second is because they're so crazy, they believe it's a false flag by the FBI.
Listen to this.
So they don't want to show up. I know we want the bad people to go away and the jerks to go away, whatever. But if you're just looking at as I've been writing for 2 years, does it grow or does it wither? Because it was not at all clear to me after January 6th where this thing was going, and lots of good things happened, including his own isolation, that made it clear that there's no movement on this regard. And I will tell you the other piece of proof of it. You have the leadership of the Republican Party totally in pretzels trying to figure out how do we deal with this because we don't want to be talking about him. They're trying to move on from January 6th, saying no protest. Why are they saying that? Because they've done the polling with the independents. And they know they could win as many crackpot congressional seats as they want. They are never going to deliver the White House with violence as an animating force.
You know, I just wanted to read this text. I assume this person is not joking. We're just talking about the Uvalde massacre. This person just texted, "The FBI allowed Uvalde to happen in order to pass gun control legislation."
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Can I stay on this Trump arrest thing? I know this is speculation, but you're sort of informed speculation as opposed to me.
Thank you.
When somebody in Manhattan County gets arrested, they are fingerprinted.
Yes.
They have a mugshot taken. Yeah. And my understanding is even at this level of potential felony, they're handcuffed.
Yeah.
I assume they're going to fingerprint Donald Trump. Yeah. I assume they're going to do a mugshot. They're not going to leave Trump around in handcuffs.
They don't need to. And that is why I mean, there's discussions going on between the parties once it happens, and the you've got a client who you can't a client a defendant who is unpredictable, but it would behoove the government, New York government, to say, the prosecutors to say, we will not handcuff him if we can just get him in and out. In other words, some quid pro quo.
A judge is not going to – if there's a motion to request – we should ask Gertner this tomorrow, Judge Gertner this
She's
tomorrow,
She's going
to
know the details.
But if there's a motion to say that his arraignment or whatever should be done on Zoom from Mar-a-Lago, judge going to allow Trump not to show up?
I don't know what the rules are in New York. Right. My favorite part of it that I wrote about was the man who became famous for questioning the name, date of birth, and other attributes of former President Barack Obama is reduced to his birther moment. It's his birther moment. It's Trump's birther moment.
Well, I just want to play this little clip from Ron DeSantis, the man who's probably going to be running against Trump, or it looks like, well, maybe he won't. But in any case, he just gave this interview to Piers Morgan. He's not really gone after Trump in any big way, but he's starting to. Mm-hmm. Here's Piers Morgan, and then you'll hear the next voice is Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida.
What's your favorite nickname that Trump's given you so far? Is it Ron de Sanctimonious or Meatball Ron?
Well, I can't...
Even he went off Meatball Ron.
I don't know how to spell de Sanctimonious. I don't really know what it means, but I kind of like it's long. It's got a lot of vowels. I mean, so we go with that. That's fine. You know, you can call me whatever you want. I mean, just as long as you also call me a winner.
Moronic question, moronic answer.
Yeah,
because Trump has not been winning. I think that would be one of the things that he would...
Trump is winning. Don't delude. Trump will have the nomination if nothing else happens to him. And if you've ever been in a room with Ron DeSantis, you would question the staying power. So
we'll see. That has been the line goes in Florida is probably not going to go in the rest of the country. He doesn't have Trump's.
Donald Trump's never going to be president of the United States.
No, well, I'd say, hey, you and I were not on that train.
We were together
the day he came down
the escalator,
and he and you and I looked at each other. He goes, he's got the nomination. I don't know if we thought he'd be president. He's got the nomination.
That is correct.
Well, because you can't stop watching him.
No, well, also, 98% name recognition is a pretty significant
and the
thing.
Apprentice,
to start, yeah.
And the knowing how to be on TV. Yeah. Ron DeSantis has got a ways to go for TV. But in any case, thank you
see
very
you,
much.
Julia,
I'll see you guys next
you
week.
You looked spectacular on CNN last night. I thought it was an off-green, gorgeous dress.
It was a mustard yellow, but we appreciate
it. Something wrong in my television.
You know, it's TV. As long as I look good, who knows? Did you hear what I said? You listen to a word I said?
Yes, you said that we're in a different environment now from January 6th, and he can't fill a room.
Yes.
And that he's not going to be able to pull this off now the way he did. He cannot deliver like he did before. He's kind of a yawn. I believe that's what you said.
Yes.
There you go.
Thank you.
Bye, Juliet. Nice to see you.
Okay, Juliet Kahn, thank you very much. Her new book with the best title ever is The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disaster. She, of course, is the former assistant secretary, for Homeland Security under President Barack Obama and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Coming up, Roger Berkowitz of Legal Seafoods fame and legacy has launched his own seafood distributing company, offering fresh seafood and prepared meals. Roger Berkowitz will join us to talk about Roger's Fish Company. He's next. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Friday, we'll be at the library with the Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, from 11 to 12. Joining us now is fishmonger, restaurateur, fish lover, Roger Berkowitz.
Since the day he was born,
Roger Berkowitz was obsessed with one thing and one thing only, fish. He wanted to know what fish were thinking. He wanted to be at one with the fish.
Well, it appears he has achieved the oneness. You may know him from Legal Seafoods. He spent 30 years as president and CEO. Now he is helming his own ship, so to speak, Rogers Fish Company. Roger Berkowitz, it's great to see you.
Thank you,
Jim. I wondered what had happened to you, and now we know.
Well, I'll tell you, I watched your video for the on the website. I just absolutely loved it. Little baby Roger in the crib looking up at the fish. Little baby Roger swimming through the water with his glasses on. It was quite a feat to be one with the fish there. Your whole life with the fish. It was absolutely hysterical. But so tell us, what's the deal? What's going on at Rogers Fish Company?
Well, after the pandemic, after we sold, I did have the license rights for doing, Legal Seafoods marketplace online. But again, when you're doing anything under license, you don't necessarily call all your own shots. You know, I had to get permission for recipes. I had to get permission who we sold to. I had to get permission for everything. And I'm just not... It just philosophically we were going in the wrong direction,
yeah.
And they're fine. I mean, they're welcome to do it. That's part of their rights. But I just thought it was much cleaner to make a break. We can do our thing; they can do their thing. And part of it was when I was doing legal, I always had this before e-commerce. It was actually. Mail order or catalog business. And I always thought, wouldn't it have been great if I just spent more time doing it because it seems like something there. Now, of course, everything is a question of timing and whatnot. The pandemic hits. People are shifting their dietary habits a little bit more from eating out in restaurants, not quite as often, more at home. This was actually the perfect time. So for me, it was sort of getting back to something I hadn't fully... consummated, if you will.
Let's talk about the tension. I mean, she didn't even ask you that question, and all of a sudden you go off on, I could use the legal name, I could not use the whatever.
Yeah.
Come on, let's get that. Look me in the eyes when I'm talking to Roger Berkowitz here. So let's start. Do you go to Legal Seafoods? You own this thing for decades.
Yes.
You know that, correct?
Occasionally, I do, yes.
You really do?
Yes.
How's the relationship with the successor companies? Good?
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Ish.
Uh-huh.
Okay-ish.
Okay. So okay, that's enough of that. Roger, so tell us what you're selling. We went to the website. It's beautiful, by the way.
I just had some.
What is the, what are you eating?
I'm eating the chowder.
We're supposed to wait to do the reviews. Damn food, Marjorie.
I wanted to have a little taste. I heard,
how is it? It's all over her face. It's on her clothes. What, is it fabulous? By the way, it is not clam chowder. It is double.
Thank you.
Now, what does that mean, Roger Berkowitz?
Okay, well, since I came up with the original clam chowder, and it was pretty good. I mean, I must say, it was. I was very happy with it. Yeah. But in selling the company, you can't use the same recipes, which is understandable. I get it. So, working with a clean sheet, I thought, how can we make this better? I go, well, I know one way of making it better. Putting in more clams and making
it. That's right. It's very clammy. Very clammy.
Now you have a little and clam chowder on your chin.
I got the clam chowder. Okay, we've also got pizzas, right?
Yeah, but are we supposed to talk about what he's doing maybe before you stop yourself?
No, I'm actually just as excited watching you eat.
Okay.
He's doing pizzas. They're right there.
I know that. So why don't you give us, include pizza.
The menu.
Tell us the kinds of things. By the way, it's Rogers, you're supposed to say the website, rogersfishco.com.
Correct. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yeah, go ahead.
So the idea here was, okay, let's do some items that are going to appeal to people at home. Mm-hmm. And let's sort of, in the restaurant, in some ways, you're kind of constricted price-wise. You don't want to be too expensive because you don't want the overall experience to be too high. Well, post-pandemic, with the cost of labor and everything else, that, eating out has kind of skyrocketed. So people have sort of shifted in some ways. I mean, they're always going to go to full service restaurants for celebratory reasons and whatnot, but why can't they have restaurant quality product or enhanced restaurant quality product at home? And because the paradigm of eating out is changing. I'll give an example. Let's say you like Chardonnay. And you like cake bread Chardonnay, which is a great Chardonnay. Most, really good full-service restaurants carry it. Well, the cake bread family used to sell a great quality Chardonnay to restaurants and a lesser quality one in package stores. So the pandemic hits.
I didn't know that. It was lesser quality in the package stores?
Yes, yes,
really?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
So, but, you know, because they wanted to take care of their restaurant customers, which is understandable. So, all right, the pandemic hits. Restaurants are closed for 6 months. Then they open for, you know, at half capacity. So they're not. So the cake bread family goes, hey, what am I going to do with all this this wine? So they end up selling the really good stuff into package stores. So instead of paying $135 a bottle in a restaurant, you can now buy that same bottle for $35 or $40 in a package store. So that's really where the model is getting shifted a little bit. And so if people are eating home more often because they see it as being a greater value, why shouldn't they get better quality products?
You know, you still have, what are you selling on the damn?
And I'm Roger's a fishmonger. Fish
okay, but what are the kinds of things, Roger Berkowitz, that are available? So, I'll tell you in front of me, I'll give you a little hand. I have this double clam chowder,
yes, delicious.
Whatever. I assume there are other soups.
Yes,
that are,
lobster bisque.
Yes, yes. We have a more lobster bisque.
You do?
Yes.
And what else?
And we have a cream of corn. No, I'm sorry, cream of crab with corn chowder, which I have to say, that's the sleeper because, you know, people are tasting it and go, oh, my God, that's really good.
Okay, so, I'm trying to help. Marjorie's just fawning over you. I'm trying to do a real interview here.
I just had the pizza.
Okay, what... What kind of pizza should Marjorie
I think
have?
This is. I think is this the clam and the bacon?
Yes, that is the clam.
Fantastic.
And the bacon. Oh, good.
Yeah,
thank
what
you.
A combination.
Thank you.
So the deal is.
Whoa! What other kind of pizza do we have? Let's find out.
We
what the
have
guy's
lobster
here.
And truffle.
Ooh.
Yeah. So we're sort of pushing the envelope and if you were to have a lobster and truffle. You know, pizza in a restaurant, you're going to pay some pretty
really
significant
good.
Dollars.
Yes,
not that it's inexpensive, but again, it's sort of creating a buffer and making it more reasonable.
And you have a cooked lobster you can do. You have pieces of fish. There. And here, I want to talk to you about the fish. What is this nitrogen freezing deal that you're...
Nitro-fresh.
You theoretically, you created something. What did you do exactly with the freezing thing?
So this is an interesting story that goes
back...
You have
to speak into the mic.
Okay, so, thank you.
Don't you have a podcast or something?
Yeah, I used to do it, yeah.
You're talking to the mic in the
I'm
podcast?
I'm talking. Okay. Sometimes, yes.
Okay. okay, so go ahead.
About 40 years ago, true story, Julia Childs was telling me she had some really good fish that was flash frozen on a boat in Seattle. And I go, come on, Julia, there's no way in hell that's going to be nearly as good as fresh. Oh, no, it was. All right. So I go, all right, I just filed it away. And then it's fast forward, you know, like 10 years ago, my daughter is on a semester abroad in all places, Tasmania.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's pretty far away. That probably says something. But anyway, the... So I went to visit her, and I thought, you know, it's an island republic. I'm sure they have a seafood business. So I got friendly with some of the folks in the seafood business. And I got taken out to this oyster farm on the East Coast somewhere. And they had one customer. It was the Japanese. And they had one product they were selling the Japanese, and it was oysters. Except the oysters were shocked and put under nitrogen. So I'm going, there's no way in hell this is going to be any good. You know, I'm reluctant because my old thoughts about freezing. So they said, you sit down here. We're going to give you some oysters that have been under nitrogen for 2 weeks and some we've just shucked. You tell us the difference.
Ooh.
I could not.
Is that true?
I could not tell the difference.
Pretty exciting.
So then I started really getting into Japanese technology and trying to understand what the Japanese were doing differently. So long story short, we developed this sort of proprietary process where we do utilize nitrogen and a couple of other steps all naturally to really give products. So what happens now, and this is the reason for doing it, particularly now post-pandemic, a fishing boat goes out, all right? And when it comes in, it's been out usually, unless it's a day boat, 1 to 5 days.
Yep.
Well, they call everything on that boat fresh. Okay. Well, maybe the last 1 or 2 days catch would come under that. Then a wholesaler comes and buys product. Now, does that product sit in their wholesale operation for 1 to 3 days? Yeah, could. And then it gets to a restaurant or a market. And could that theoretically fresh fish be there 1 to 3 days? Yes. So that's kind of nuts because it really, you know, it's a misnomer what is fresh. If I get the last 1 or 2 days catch off a boat and put it under nitrogen immediately, I will maintain that that product tastes much fresher than a product that theoretically is fresh on someone's menu.
There was that, you know, you may not remember this. You've been around a while. There was some business in town.
Was that a reference to my age?
No, I can't remember what the name of the place. Remember the slogan for some company in town, Marjorie? Was something like, if it isn't fresh.
It is illegal. Yes, I do.
Did you ever hear
that?
I can't remember what business that was.
Something like
that. What business? Do you remember that?
Yeah. I'm probably going to have to change that. Rogers,
by the way, in all serious, is this stuff frozen that we're eating here now?
Yes.
I just had a crab cake. I hate to. This is. It really tastes fabulous. These crab cakes. You try the crab cakes.
I will in a second. We haven't explained, though. So you can go online and order what you want. Mm-hmm. And it's delivered?
Yeah.
To your home?
Yes.
So you could order in a lobster, you could order in the pizza, you could order in whatever you want right to the house.
Right.
That you have cooked, and do you need to cook it when it gets to the house?
See, here's the thing. No. You put it in your freezer. See, that's one of the problems. I was looking at these Blue Aprons and whatever. They send you this fresh product, and you have like 2.5 days to use it before it goes. And it's kind of like an anchor. It's not convenient at all. When you get this, stick it in your freezer. I mean, I hate to tell people they have that. Up to 9 months, because when you use nitrogen, it freezes in a matter of minutes, not in a matter of hours, so that the cell structure is never compromised.
So you could put a lobster in your freezer?
Well, yes, you actually could. There'd be less suffering when you put it that way. But
Okay.
By the way, let's talk about that for a second before we get back to your business. You remember when I almost ended your career when I met you the first time?
Yes.
Can we relive that moment for a second? So Roger Berkowitz is this big, famous, iconic, you know, all the commercials, you know, The Voice, you know, this whatever. And he's on this is when I had this Under the Radar show on NECN years ago. We used to have a quiz, correct? And Roger came on. I think one of your kids was there because he was so excited. And Roger was taking the quiz that I was giving him. Do you remember how many of the questions he got right before the final answer?
Boy, was that the if it was the first? Actually, I think it was the second time.
Do you remember how many?
I don't know how many.
I remember. You got none. Right. None, actually. And then, because we felt bad for him, I think, my producers, by John Binskoyuk or somebody, you know, who's now a selectman, actually, in your hometown, asked him a question that was sort of a softball kind of thing. Do you remember what the question was?
Something about how would I prepare? Yes, it was indelible on my mind. How would
it's like 20 years ago, by the way, but go ahead.
How would I prepare a blue lobster?
Now, we knew what the answer was going to be, and it'd take him 1 second, so he wasn't humiliated in front of his child and thousands of people watching the show. And he doesn't answer right away. And the sweat is pouring down his face because he realizes if he gets the wrong answer to how do you prepare a blue lobster, it's over for Mr. Legal Seafood. Do you know how to prepare a blue lobster?
I have no idea.
You don't prepare a blue lobster.
Because there isn't any such thing?
No, they're rare. They're like one in a hundred million.
So you donate it to a museum.
And then finally, you eked out the correct answer with a sigh of incredible relief.
What shade of blue is a blue
lobster? Oh, I've seen them.
Is it like navy blue or is it like
a cobalt blue?
Yeah, it's really kind of great. Okay, let's get back to the...
I have a question.
Okay.
I just want to know about you being wanting to be one with the fish and dreaming of fish as a child and swimming with the fish and all that.
It's not swimming with the fish. That's
well,
a different...
Was, no, swimming with the fish.
I was, metaphorically, yes.
But yeah, so... Is that true, or is that just a marketing thing? I mean, were you obsessed with fish as an early age?
My father had a fish market in Inman Square, and he worked long hours, and if we wanted to see him, then we were at the fish market. So, sort of a degree of separation, but yes.
So you had a fascination with fish, and were you fascinated by the fish that were in the on ice in the containers, or were you fascinated by looking up in the old Encyclopedia Britannica, the story of the fish?
Or the Americana, if you couldn't afford the Britannica.
That's right, yeah. I mean, what was it?
It's probably a combination of the two. I mean, I could only... My mother was not a particularly good cook, but my father would fry fish and chips, and they were really good. So I really liked fried fish, and we enjoyed having it at home when he would bring it in.
So did you go scuba diving and stuff in later life? Kind of
so so this is
fishes?
Actually funny. I have always, this is a true story. I'm paranoid of swimming in water with fish. And
that's not true.
No, that is true. I did it once. I did scuba diving once. in the
Caribbean?
In Eilat.
Ooh.
Eilat. What's that?
Where would that be?
Never heard of it.
It's in Israel.
Israel.
And,
okay.
And one of the kids had a bar mitzvah and over there, and that's what we did. And so there was our tour guide was a former Mossad,
secret
SEAL.
Agent.
And he said, "You guys want to go scuba diving? Well, I know it like takes what, 2 or 3 weeks or 6 weeks to get certified." We had a 15-minute lesson in broken English. And as I'm wading into the water, first of all, the kids ran ahead of me. They did it. As I'm wading into the water, I'm thinking, can I walk and breathe at the same time? Can I? So the answer is yes, you figure it out. But so fish were coming near me. And I was like cringing, and the kids were laughing. And then in the distance, there was a dolphin and a baby approaching me.
Oh my God.
And I'm saying to myself, it's not a shark. It's not a shark. And it came right up to me, and my arm was stuck to my side.
Oh my God.
Couldn't do it. And so after that, I thought I was.
What'd your shrink tell you about that?
Well, I don't know, but I have to tell you, I thought I was over my phobia, and a couple of years later, I was swimming and there was some fish around me, and I freaked out. In fact, I freaked out. I embarrassed one of my kids because there was sort of this pond pool in Disney World, and you can snorkel, and a skate started to come up towards me, and I freaked out.
This is very sad.
So,
we're talking to Roger Berkowitz.
The man
Roger's
I
fish
thought
company.
Has been living with fish.
Is he here to talk about his
fish,
business or to talk
about fish? Really is a little nervous about fish.
Live fish, seeing live fish.
Finally,
I will.
Okay.
Yeah, well,
dead
they're
ones
frozen,
okay.
So you don't have to worry about it. Now, let me ask you something about the,
under
serious,
nitrogen.
I'm interested in the nitrogen thing. I do a lot of this. Marjorie does not. I do a lot of this higher quality food at home thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do the put it all together Blue Apron deal, but you know, it's a variation of what you're doing, not so much with seafood because there's not much out there kind of thing. Mm-hmm. If the night, at least in my limited experience with your new business in the last 10 minutes, from crab cakes to this clam and bacon pizza and the fabulous clam chowder, we'll get to the dessert, which I didn't even know you had in a second.
Yes,
this tastes much better than normal frozen stuff. So why isn't everybody doing, if nitrogen is obviously the trick, why isn't everybody doing it?
It's expensive.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah. And usually nitrogen has been used for doing a lot of product, and it could be middling quality product, but doing it very quickly. So it's efficient in that regard. It is not efficient when you do small amounts, and that.
By the way, is this how's it for the environment? Nitrogen and that stuff, is it okay?
I think it's okay.
Well, I may want to check that out.
So I have another question.
Yes, it's fine.
Okay,
it's
fine.
I have another question about the Roger Berkowitz life.
Yes.
I mean, you were enormously successful. How many legal seafoods were there? I mean, tons and tons.
The 30s,
into the 30s. So you could have just retired. You wouldn't want to spend your life scuba diving and snorkeling after
apparently
the horrific
not.
Stories you've just told us. But you could kind of just relax.
Take it easy kind of thing.
Yeah. But you didn't. You wanted to go into something else. So why?
ADD.
ADD, is
yes,
that it?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yes, yes. I've got to be doing, something, all the time. I didn't want the pandemic to sort of be the defining point at the end when I still had things that I wanted to do, particularly with fish and particularly in the hospitality business.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about that, though, that what a disaster that was for everyone's business in the restaurant
Well,
business.
You know,
it must have been depressing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think that the restaurant model, was having some issues in general. I mean, this was a universal thing because it's so labor intensive. And then after the pandemic, legislation got passed and the model really kind of went upside down. So it made it very, very difficult, I think, for restaurants to continue to do what they did, given the cost of labor, given the increased cost of goods going up. And if that's the case, then a new model needed to emerge. Now, quick service restaurants, I think by virtue of the fact that they're not labor intensive, are picking up some of the slack. But the full service model has to, I think, undergo further iteration. And it's not that people are going to abandon them. I think people are still going to go out to full service restaurants for celebratory reasons and that kind of thing. But I just don't think they're going to do it as frequently as
they must. Well, we talk about this all the time, because if you're going to pay great wages to the back of the of the kitchen, for, you know, top to bottom, you're going to have to charge a lot more for your food. And then I think, obviously, that will make going out to dinner like going to the Red Sox, you know, with five people. It's unaffordable.
Yes. That's exactly what
hey,
happening.
We're talking to Roger Berkowitz, whose new venture as of Monday, actually 2 days ago, Roger's Fish Company. It's Roger's Fish Co. co.com. You remember a play called The Proposition in Inman Square?
Yes, I do.
You do, really?
Yeah, of course.
Laurie Heineman writes, I was original cast member of The Proposition.
Wow.
An improv comedy show was located next to the original Legal Seafoods 50 years ago. Please thank your guest, that would be you, and possibly his father, that would be George Berkowitz, for being so gracious to us. Should he thank the producers?
Oh.
Because I think it was then that someone came up with the idea of making meals to go, which the audience for our show would get before the show. Is there some...
Well, we always had a little bit of a takeout area, but, I mean, it always goes back to the early days. My father bought the building next to the original, my grandfather's market and his fish store. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know what to do with it. First, we were, you know, trying to say, well, do we process fish out of here? And then Alan Albert, I believe, was the first director of the Proposition, and there was an early crew, and some great people came out of that show. But that became the theater right next to the restaurant.
Okay, so before you, by the way, you're doing desserts too. What's with that?
Yeah.
So
what is that thing?
So I've got this guy Rick Katz. So those are the, I don't know if you know Rick.
He's the
Katz.
Guy has the place in next to
Pico
Calderwood Pavilion. Little pizza joint and pizza and Italian and
No, no. He was in the South End. He had Pico.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Go ahead.
So he's been doing that, and he was actually a baker for me many years ago prior to doing that. But when he opened Pico, a guy comes up from the New York Times and said, "This is the best pizza crust I've ever tasted." And Rick is an absolute fanatic. So he's doing
fabulous
sourdough pizza crust, hand stretched. He pulled me off the line. I was trying to do it, and he told me I couldn't do it anymore. I didn't have the.
Well, this is quite delicious. Now, you were really evasive in the Globe interview when you were asked how much money you invested in the new business. So feel free. How much did you invest? How much, Roger Berkowitz, have you invested in the new business?
I'll requote the Globe a lot.
A lot.
But, no, it's, you know, the startups are not inexpensive.
And is that, I assume this is, how do you get the, I mean, people know you here. Obviously, you're, I mean, in all seriousness, your voice is recognizable. Obviously, your brand, a term I hate, but it was really immense. And I think people loved you and loved your place. Obviously, the goal is to move this beyond your traditional catchment area where there have been legal seafoods, I assume, right?
Yes.
How do you get that? What do you do? Quickly, if you can.
You know, we talk a little bit about the nitrogen difference. We talk about coming up with items that you can't typically get in restaurants or that you won't get in restaurants. And so it's a point of differentiation and a bit of education.
Well, the food is terrific, I have to say. It's really good, and we're really happy you're back in the biz.
Thank you.
And it's really nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
It's really sad that you're scared of fish, though. That is actually rather pathetic. I would have kept that to myself if I were you.
I think that makes him a real guy telling a real story.
So. It makes him like a wimp.
But it doesn't ruin the video for me with all the fish with glasses on. That was my favorite
part. Is that video on your website?
It's great.
Just in the press release. Is that video on the website?
Yes, it is now on the website.
It is fabulous.
Check it out.
Roger Berkowitz. Congratulations.
Congratulations,
Roger. And thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for bringing me such a wonderful lunch, which I'm going to continue
to eat. Can I tell you
a
secret, by the way, on the air?
Yes.
She's not crazy about fish. You know she loves your shrimp.
Shrimp.
Oh, yes.
For her to be eating
next week.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent.
For her to be eating and raving about seafood kinds of thing, pizza, crab, is unheard of.
I'm not,
with Marjorie Egan.
I think I'd have to, I couldn't eat a piece of salmon. Something wrong with me, I guess. Anyway.
Roger, good luck. It's great to see you. Be well.
This is wonderful. Thank you very much for being here. Fishmonger and restaurateur Roger Berkowitz, who was the president for many years of the famous and CEO of the famous Legal Seafoods, and now he's got this great new thing going on, Roger's Fish Company.
Relationship with Legal Seafoods, fabulous, by the way. Don't
fabulous.
Worry about that
Absolutely
at all.
It's fabulous.
Everything's really good.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk with business columnist Shirley DeYoung. She's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. We're back at the library on Friday. The Attorney General is with us for Ask the AG, Andrea Campbell, 11 to noon. Joining us now on Zoom is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. Hey, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey there.
Hey, great to talk to you, Shirley. So you are an Asian woman. There was a fascinating story about Asian kids in the Boston Public Schools. And you don't really hear, we hear a lot about African-American kids struggling, Latino kids struggling. You don't hear much about the travails of Asian kids. So what did this report about these kids say?
It said that a lot of, well, not only am I an Asian woman, but I am an Asian mother to Asian, two
That's
Asian
right.
boys.
That's right.
To Asian kids. So this really struck a chord that Asian American students at in Boston Public Schools, they don't feel safe. They feel invisible. I think the lead of the story by my colleague Deanna Pan was that you know, a student had a Vietnamese name and has a Vietnamese name, and her teacher could never pronounce it correctly and didn't even try. And sometimes teachers gave students with difficult names, they gave them nicknames like Americanized names. I'm just going to call you Wendy because I can't pronounce your name. And so and it was really fascinating because you think there's this image or narrative out there that all Asian American kids are super smart. They don't need any help in school, they can just be left alone. And this story said no, they're just like anybody else. Some do well, but some struggle and they need attention and they need to, and they're not the model minority. And so I thought it was a really important study that was done about Asian American students. And if you think about the coverage, right, it tends to focus on Boston Latin and how many Asian American students are there, right?
Right.
Well, you know, you said like everyone else, this survey suggests worse than everyone else in some ways. They suggest that in terms of feeling isolated, feeling undervalued, that Asian kids in the BPS actually rate their treatment worse than Black kids, Latino kids, et cetera. By the way, I've mentioned this in the air before. My kids are Chinese and Chinese American. They were at Cambridge Ringe in Latin. I've told you before, every Chinese kid by one particular employee was called Mei Mei. That is not that aberrational of a kind of thing.
Mea culpa. I'm one of the worst pronouncers of names going. I mean, if I were a teacher, I suppose I'd try. But
trying is it seems to be an absence of trying here, sort of a stereotyping kind of thing.
You know what I was always thinking? You just mentioned your kids are Chinese. I mean, it's like we lob everybody together. You know, there's Chinese kids, there's Japanese kids, Korean kids, Cambodian
Vietnamese kids, right.
Vietnamese kids from Laos. I mean, there's all these different countries. And I would imagine, culturally, those kids are very different. In many ways, they're very, very, very different. So to lump them all in a big group is not really fair either.
And now, because when I was growing up, back in the 70s, a lot of us, far suburb of Baltimore, a lot of us were immigrants. But today, it's a mix of immigrants. Mm-hmm. And kids like mine, which are second generation. My kids don't speak. I mean, my husband's Korean, so my kids speak neither Chinese nor Korean. I have to say my youngest, he's very interested in Asian culture, and he's the way he learns Chinese is through John Cena, the wrestler, because he's been learning Chinese. So he's been watching all these YouTube videos of John Cena. And it's interesting because like half the I was like, I don't know what that first sentence was in Chinese, but I understand the second half of your sentence. That sounds like Chinese to me. But one of the things I also worry is we've talked about before is the growing hate, right, against Asian Americans in this country that started with that really heated up during the pandemic, right?
Right.
When
thanks to Trump.
thanks to Trump blaming the coronavirus, the virus COVID-19 on Chinese starting, you know, allegedly starting in Wuhan, but really, you know, blamed it on Chinese people for spreading it, and that came over to America, and we saw the Chinatowns empty out, and now I worry about growing tension between U.S. and China. Like, I worry about that backlash against my kids when they grow up. And Jim, your daughters,
yep,
too.
No, they've seen it. They have indeed. We're talking to Shirley the Young. You know, David Scharfenberg, does he ever write a simple piece, this guy?
He's very talented.
I mean, he's really a talented young journalist. He writes a piece about Upham's Corner, and the theme seems to be the bumper sticker, development without disbursement. And the basic notion is, when a poorer community starts to rise up, it generally means a gentrification. It means a, you know, a JP kind of thing, a South End kind of thing, whatever. But he suggests that
black and Latinos get shoved out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Poor people and people of color. Yeah. He says this research has identified 193 communities in the country, including there's a swath of the financial district in Chinatown, Federal Hill in Providence. But he focuses on Upham's Corner and says this is one of the 193. And then he explains, which is of most value, what the conditions externally and internally are that cause them to be a good outlier. Fill in some blanks if you can, Shirley. It's amazing, actually.
Yeah, this is a masterful story by David. And I mean, he loves kind of getting into data, right? And this is a very data-driven story, a look at these census tracts and poverty, rates of poverty. And I was trying to think about how to summarize, you know, what happened to Upham's Corner. It was very poor. I mean, did you read that about the history about how it was so poor that the landlords and that would burn down the buildings intentionally for the insurance money? And I guess John Barrows was like 5 years old in that neighborhood. He still remembers the buildings in his neighborhood being burned
and hearing the screams.
Yeah. Hearing the screams. And people died, you know, just kind of outrageous. And I think it comes down to, neighborhoods where it was filled with people who cared, really. I mean, ultimately it was like, you had residents who cared, you had, relatively high rates of ownership, low vacancy rates. You had, and also there was
higher rates of self-employment, because that means meaning they're entrepreneurs there, which is really
higher
interesting.
Higher rates of homeownership.
Yeah, she said, yeah.
High rates,
said, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then also, like, there was also a healthy mix of subsidized housing, you know, in there as well. And so it just begins to paint a picture of what it would take. How could you replicate this model across the city?
You know, the one thing you just mentioned this in passing, though, and David does more than in passing. He lists the eight elements. I think there are three that are external. People should read the story. Shirley listed most of them. And then five that are internal. And then the issue is, can you replicate them, et cetera. The thing that's really important, though, that I'm not sure you can plan for quite as well, is what you said, the human element. He profiles a couple of people who basically said, I'm staying here, or I'm moving here, regardless of what it's going to be like in the short run, who really, along with those objective factors, for lack of an expression, sort of help change and develop and allow the community to flourish. So you do need homesteaders who are seriously committed to the community.
Well, you know what I loved? Because it reminded me of my hometown, Fall River, where a lot of people came from Cape Verde as well. He talked about Cape Verdeans in Upham's Corner, this one particular family, that they came and they bought these triple-deckers that were cheap. And then
they bought the whole block, didn't they?
Well, it worked up to bought the whole block. They started with one house and they worked on it meticulously. And I remember in Fall River, there were so many people from the Azores that painted their homes these Caribbean colors, like, you know, because Azores is off the coast of West Africa, you know, the pinks and the blues and stuff.
Wow.
And they would paint those colors around the foundation. They would outline the foundation of stones in those colors. But this Japina family, that's right, they started with just one place and they
great
built more and more stuff. Or they talked about the De Silva family and how they had the planted all these gardens in the backyard and spent endless hours fixing it up. So it was
and then
really...
they rented below market the mm-hmm. whole damn block to families.
Yes. So
I mean,
people
it's just
could
really
come
great
over
story.
And join them right. from the Azores. And in Fall River, they, from St. Michael's, there were all these families. They all came from the same island. Yeah. It was really something. And the houses were perfect and meticulously maintained.
So from the good news in Upham's Corner to, at least according to some, the bad news at a Catholic school, 7 to 12, I think.
Yeah,
for
great job
girls
on this story,
yeah, it
Shirley.
Is, you did a terrific job. Tell us
the nuns don't look too good here.
Nor they don't. And also words like Judas being thrown around directed at some of the people here. Take it away, Shirley.
So this was a story. The story happened, I think, March, second week of March, it was announced that Mount Alvernia High School, which is an all-girls Catholic school, it would be closing after, I don't know if it was like almost nearly a century. And the storyline is that the sisters who own the property where this high school is on, it's the Missionary Franciscan Sisters of the Immaculate Conception. They sit on 23 acres in Newton. They own this for a long time, and they wanted to sell the property. They couldn't maintain the buildings there. The sisters, there are only 11 sisters now who live on the convent on the property. The high school occupies buildings, has been using and renting buildings from the sister for decades. And so when they decide to sell the property, they also the school had to close. And what parents and alumni and students are really upset about is, like, why wasn't there a more humane transition? Why wasn't the board given more notice? And one of the things I focused on is, the sisters apparently had an offer from Newton Country Day School, which is another all-girls Catholic school across the street.
Across the street, yeah.
I went out to Newton. I mean, literally, right across the street. The entrances are like, the driveways are across the street, right? That's on Center Street in Newton. And so Newton Country Day School, you think a like-minded institution, offered to pay a fair, a competitive price, market price for the 23 acres in cash. And they would take in the remaining 135 Mount Alvernia students, and they would preserve the history, so that the girls who are there wouldn't be, left to kind of find, the board did make the Mount Alvernia board did make a partnership with Fontbonne Academy in Milton. So girls can go there, have been offered
long way from Newton,
but it's probably, probably half an hour at least away without traffic. But the sisters were not interested in that deal. And I did reach out to the sisters. They wouldn't say, they said they're talking to several buyers. They have not sold the property yet, but they wouldn't explain why they rejected the Newton Country Day deal. But they said that, they need to leave. They can't maintain the buildings. And so that's caused a lot of, a lot of parents. And I think the Judas comment is from Senator Mike Rush. Who has a seventh grader there, because it doesn't add up. Like, why would they not take the Newton Country
deal? Well, I think we know, don't we?
Bigfoot.
Now it's emerged that Boston College, now that the school is closing, they're very interested in buying the property now. And Boston College, by the way, is also directly across the street from Mount Alvernia / the sisters.
Yeah, the law school, right? Is the law school right there.
The law school there. And then Newton Country Day. So just to keep this in mind, Newton Country Day and Boston College are next to each other. So they're neighbors. So basically two neighboring Catholic institutions are vying for the sister's property.
Yeah, but one's going to allow the kids to continue their education as it was. One is not.
But I mean, here's what I wonder: exactly. is the question? I mean, did BC offer them a lot more money? Is that what's going on here? They bigfooted
them? I don't know. I mean, that's
BC is taking over where the cardinal lived. They got that huge part where the cardinal lived. They put up all these new dorms. They got the law school down.
Oh, you know how we can find out? Why don't we ask the nuns? Oh, the nuns only put out statements. Yet another group of people who won't talk to reporters.
But it does. It does seem. I mean, unless BC made them an offer, they couldn't refuse. I don't know.
Can we move on here?
Well, no,
we don't know the answer. I mean, we know it's Bigfoot.
Do we know the answer, Shirley?
Which has more power, Boston College or Newton Country Day? I mean, come on.
Well, Newton Country Day had a $50 million endowment. I thought that was pretty impressive. Yeah. Not as big as Boston College, but that's the supposition, right, that they were outdone. Right. Okay.
They were outdone.
So, Shirley, this story we thought was perfect for you, sort of, because unless I got it wrong, because Marjorie wasn't sure I was right, didn't we talk to you during the pandemic where you had two huge dumpsters outside your house?
And just one, whatever.
And you kept doing a Marie Kondo thing, filling this damn thing up. Now, a variation on the theme is there's a story in your paper about the Buy Nothing movement, which apparently has 7 million Facebook users involved, where it's a reuse anti-consumer movement kind of thing, where you basically work with your neighbors to offer to them something that you're not interested in that might be of value to them, maybe diapers that are too small now. That sort of. There's also a dead hamster in a bag mentioned, which I don't quite understand who would want that. But this thing,
and
this
sometimes
is
food. They
and
offer
sometimes food, right? Right, which is also useful in tough times because of inflation. I should have said that. But this is a huge, and apparently in Boston in particular, a hugely growing movement, no?
It is, and I've seen the Facebook pages, and I did think about, should I just put everything on the, you know, the Buy Nothing Facebook pages, but it's too much time, right?
Yeah, it does require work.
You have to pick somebody to give it to. You have to make arrangements. But people love this. People love free stuff. They love buying and or not really buying, but giving away their stuff and stuff where, you know, maybe it's still in really good use, but it can find a new home, maybe in the neighborhood. This is a great story by my colleague Dee Dee Coley on this Buy Nothing movement, which actually, you know, was around before the pandemic, but really has taken off because everybody was at home trying to. I mean, you were also right when you were stuck at home, you were also clearing out stuff, right?
I was, and I still am. Yeah. I am like totally into this, even though Marie Kondo has abandoned us. I have done I am continuing the tradition of the great Marie Kondo.
So Memorial Day this coming, it's the 1 year anversary of, you know, renting
your dumpster. Yeah, that was
a
great moment.
I think we're going to do it again.
That's beautiful. I can't wait. By the way, we're going to discuss this with our listeners. Are we right at the end of the show? Yeah, we are. We're going to take your calls on the Buy Nothing.
Buy Nothing, yeah. Kind of thing. So Shirley Young, I thought this sounded like a great idea until I was
Well, explain what it is first.
Of something else by Jim Browdy. But this idea
when
you buy all this stuff online and then you don't like it, it's a real pain in the neck to have to return it. And I guess the companies lose a lot of money on this. And so this online, this new deal,
two women
started this return thing. Tell us about the return thing, and then Jim can throw cold water on it.
Well, not totally. Go ahead.
Well, it's called Return Queen, and it's actually, this has got like 25 employees in Boston. It's an app, and it helps you. I love the quote. The quote from one of the executives, they want to make returning as easy as shopping. And so I think they'll come into your house and return your stuff for you. And so it's like, oh, that's a good idea. Now, I didn't read the fine print. I mean, do they charge? I mean, how much does it cost you?
Well, it's $20 a month or $100 a year, which, and they make the point. In light of the fact that I didn't know that 16% of stuff that people buy is returned, 100% of stuff of some people I know is actually returned who shall remain unnamed. However, the story is written like this is some revolutionary thing. One of my kids the other day had me return something that she bought on Amazon. And I said, I don't have time to put it in a box and whatever. And she said to me, you don't put it in a box. I just sent you the QR code from the Amazon website. You go to Whole Foods, which I was going to anyway. You hand it to customer service, no label, no box, no nothing. And they return it and you get a credit, like in an hour kind of thing. So while they're, I guess for the non-Amazon world, they're providing a great service. For those of us who have not abandoned Amazon, unfortunately, Jeff Bezos seems to be a little bit ahead of the curve yet again.
No, no. Other retailers have made it a lot easier to return.
Okay.
That's actually really, I didn't realize this, only 16% of items.
That's what's said in the story.
I mean, for someone, like, it's more like 75%. And so I return a lot. But the thing is, like, I do very little physical shopping. You know, I don't have time to go to the store. Sometimes, you know, like, I try to buy a pair of basketball shoes for my 10-year-old. And I was like, let's go to the store. I don't think he's ever, let's try on some shoes.
What,
right?
You don't think he's ever been to a store?
Oh, no, he's been to a store. Well, but okay. I was trying to keep, he's probably only one other time has gone to a store to try on shoes.
Wow.
All the time what we do is we just order a bunch online, and then whatever doesn't work gets shipped back, you know. Probably terrible for the environment. But we went to the store, but it was such a horrible, we went to the mall. It was such a horrible experience. We went to four different stores that, you know, even though online they said they had this particular shoe that he wanted from Puma.
Then they don't have it. That's so annoying.
They don't have it.
Yeah.
And so then we ended up ordering it online, and you know, they mixed up our order and whatever. But I think that'll be the last time he'll ever go to the mall to try on shoes.
Very sad story. By the way, the company is called, which we don't want to put out of business, Return Queens is the business from the two women are trying couch
days,
to couch kind of
we
thing.
We went to the little Stride Right store with the kids and the salesman came
I remember
out
well.
And they measured the feet and they measured the shoes. That's all over now.
And you know what, Marjorie, not only that, so the whole point to go to the store was to get his foot measured in that little metal thing, right?
Yeah.
You know what the store said? Oh, we don't even have those anymore.
Wow, that is bad. This is one of the saddest
no
stories I've ever heard.
No more metal shoe
okay,
measures?
Okay, let's get over it if we can.
I'm stunned.
Hey, Shirley, before you go, we talked to our listeners at the top of the show. We sort of parroted what Dan Shaughnessy said in your paper about how grotesque this advertising, this incessant around the clock, nonstop, celebrity laden, bonus bet advertising by these online gambling companies is ever. He used the word, and I wish I had. It's like grooming. It really is a grooming experience for people. That's the side I'm on. And where are you on this? What's your sense?
I agree with Dan. You know, I didn't even. You think about when casinos were rolled out. Whether it's Plainridge or Encore, I mean, you didn't have advertising like this, right?
No. Nope.
I mean, you had some advertising, but it was not like this, nonstop.
Everywhere. Social media, radio, all over the place, television, everywhere.
You tell everywhere. And also, the offers are incredible. You know, they make you stop and think, like, oh, maybe I should do this because if I bet 50, they're going to give me $200 in credits. That seems like a no lose
situation. If I bet five, I'm going to get $200 in bonus bets, theoretically.
So I'm hoping the legislature or somebody will
so
take
glad
a look
you're
at
saying
this.
Well, you know what? But before you go, I said this earlier and I said it yesterday too to Trenny quickly. You may remember this. Younger listeners will not. When Tom Birmingham, who just recently died, was either the Senate president or something, and he had a problem with the lottery, which I do too, and I know we're outliers, he limited the amount of money they could spend on advertising. So the legislature could not only do that, they could also say in every 60 seconds of ads, you don't just have to say if you have a gambling problem, call 1-800, I have a gambling problem or whatever it is. You should also say the odds are you're going to lose. I mean, say something to make it clear this is not all free money. And unfortunately, the legislature was so excited about doing this, I guess, that they chose not to take that course.
Okay, Shirley Young.
What are you going to say? I'm sorry. Yeah, one last.
No, I was going to say they should limit the advertising. They should, you know, because now also I think we've talked about it. It's so easy to place a bet. It's you know, I mean, because in the casinos they have always offered freebies, right?
But you have to go.
Go somewhere, right? Yeah. You have to go somewhere. You got to board a bus.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Shirley Young, thank
are
you,
you doing,
very
by
much.
By the way, are you doing online gambling yet? Because you were doing DraftKings. Remember you were winning even before you even knew what a football was?
I don't have time to do
okay, good. I'm glad to hear it. Goodbye, Shirley.
Shirley, thank
nice
you very much.
I've
been talking with the Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. That's right, she's too busy buying clothes. And
seven pair of shoes.
Coming up, food policy writer Corby Cutler joins us to talk about the people taking the fight against factory farming to the courts and some very disappointing news about little kids and lunches. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we're at the library. Oh, what day is today? Wednesday?
Wednesday.
We're at the library on Friday. And the Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, will join us from 11 to 12. Take your questions and ours. We're joined now by food policy analyst Corby Comer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Good afternoon, Corby Comer.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie.
Good afternoon to you.
So, Corby Comer, we've talked to you a lot about the cruelty involved in factory farming, but there seems to be a new strategy of kicking cases to court. What's going on with this chicken thing?
I love this.
So it's not a new strategy. Animal activists for a long time have been doing things like trying to release animals that are supposed to be killed from trucks that are taking them to the slaughterhouse. Or in this case, animal rescue. That is the new coming to trial strategy of animal activists who are like pulling their two women who were tried in Merced County, California, for taking two chickens worth theoretically $8.16 apiece off a truck as they were headed for slaughter and stealing them. Of course, they wanted this to be publicized. They set it up. They wanted to be arrested, and they wanted it to be brought to trial. They're calling it a rescue. It's great what the discovery led to in the trial. For example, these animals were too sick to be slaughtered. They had bacteria in their systems that could have led to human illness. Of course, the birds, as we all know, are bred to not be able to walk on their legs by the time they're ready for slaughter because they're so heavy. Because we like white meat, breast meat makes them too heavy to stand. So calling attention to the pathetic, severely ill animals that often are going to the slaughterhouse is a way of drawing attention to the incredibly inhumane raising activities of these slaughterhouses. And finally, trials, juries are finding for the complainants and for the activists instead of lawyers getting them successfully dismissed as nuts and cranks, as has been the case in the past. So even if jury decisions set no precedent for future jury trials, as Jim the lawyer would know, and I didn't quite realize, it sets a chilling precedent for companies that are less arrogant about winning every trial against animal activists. So it's a really good thing.
Well, it also gives them a forum, as you've made clear, to essentially to publicize their cause. And actually, part of that, Alexandra Paul, who I read is an actress. I'm not sure where she's acting.
Baywatch. How could you
know? Is that true? Oops, sorry. Baywatch actress, Alexandra Paul, is one of the two women who kidnapped or stole or rescued, I should say, the two chickens. Here she is, a little piece of her testimony at the Foster Farms trial.
Chickens were still being boiled alive and buried alive, and that nobody had done anything in the last 6 years. And you feel like, who is going to do something if not I?
Well, good for her. You know, one of the things they argue is that in terms of this legal strategy that you're describing there, sort of the next line, which they haven't yet achieved. I mean, obviously, the next line is what the big time animal rights lawyers are trying to do is get personhood for, like, you know, apes and chimps. Now, I'm not sure we're getting there yet, but they make a case which I find really compelling, which hasn't won yet in court, the necessity defense. And meaning that if a human is in great distress kind of thing, what's a good example? Or a dog, they would say, is okay. In a car, you can break into the car if it's a hot day and rescue the dog. They want to make the case, which I have a feeling we're approaching, is that there's a necessity for a human being who's confronted with the torture of these animals, like these chickens. And by the way, it's far worse than just what Corby and she were describing briefly in that tape of that testimony, that it's a necessity, if you see it, that you rescue the pig, the chicken, the whatever, which is going to put even a tighter vise around the necks of these huge factory farms, I hope, anyway.
There's just one photograph of workers in a chicken slaughterhouse from an animal activist film, because, you know, there are lots of Iowa producers that were forbidden by state law.
I know that. I know.
Ever.
I know.
It was what the camera ban that they could get arrested, animal activists releasing these videos. Just one in the Mother Jones story of a blood-covered floor and workers in yellow raincoats and hoods, but still the yellow is obscured by blood. The whole thing rests on the great Stalin line, the death of one man is a tragedy, the death of a million is a statistic. It's drawing attention to the one animals and the way they're treated.
You know, just one question. If people want to eat chicken and they don't want to eat chicken that was raised this way, is there anything they can do?
They try to go to a family farm. They try to go to a farm that makes a big deal, which we hope is actually true publicity, how they raise their animals and their slaughterhouse practices.
So like
and
Whole Foods. So like Whole Foods.
Check out Farm Aid, which is the organization Willie Nelson runs. And a friend, Carolyn Mugar, has been the executive director forever, which champions through Neil Young, Willie Nelson, Mellencamp, Dave Matthews, family farmers.
So
they have all that kind of information.
So the Whole Foods chicken or the Trader Joe's chicken is not in that category of
the Whole Foods has its own humane
the 1 to 5 rating
that they decided that they would do. The Animal Welfare Institute has a nationally recognized seal, so look for that kind of seal on a package.
You know, it's someday we have to have a reckoning in the studio, the two of us. I don't know how we can react to these kinds of stories like we do and go home and have a piece of chicken or a hamburger. I mean, it's just, it's really, it's voluntary blindness on the part of you and me. I think it really is.
Well, Corby has changed my eating habits. I mean, you really have.
I mean, you're better. You're more sensitive to the treatment, but.
Yes. Or, I mean, I think you can at least go to a store that has those
humane
labels.
Treatment, yeah.
You can at least do that. It costs you a lot more money, but it seems to me it's worth it.
You know, a couple of years ago, we spoke to Jill Shaw from the Shaw Family Foundation about creating kitchens on site in the Boston public schools. I don't know what the status is now, but I know how wonderful it was then. They were working, I think, with Ken Oringer also.
Ken Oringer.
Who was doing a lot of great. That's that fabulous scene in the movie they put together where Ken Oringer is teaching these 70-something lunch ladies at a Boston public school about how to cook tofu. It is a classic moment. Forever. But in any case, on one end of the spectrum are efforts like that that are going on in place, some school systems. The other end of the spectrum, which I assume is the vast majority, is Lunchables being served. I mean, tell us what's going on with big companies and things like Lunchables in school cafeterias.
You know, I'm an incurable optimist, and so I actually see optimism in the idea that Lunchables have reformulated to qualify for School Nutrition Association.
They're healthier than they are in the supermarket is the point, right?
Right. And what I'm really hoping, and has not happened yet, is that by reducing the sodium, which is the single worst and most dangerous part of Lunchables, it's really bad, like lunch and meat. You know, ham and chicken and luncheon meats, they are sky high in sodium. It's terrible to get kids used to high sodium foods because once you get used to having a lot of salt in Progresso or Campbell's soup, I will name names, you want everything to be really salty. Whereas if everything that's being marketed and you are having at your school, for example, is lower in sodium, you get used to being desensitized or more sensitive to salt and not liking salt. So what's happening is, you know, whenever school nutrition standards change, and Michelle Obama did fabulous things about trying to get more whole grains, more fresh fruits and vegetables into lunches, which the Shaw Family Foundation and Ken Oringer go way, way farther than, and Newman's Own, there's lots of groups trying to help lunches be made from scratch, but that's a very high hurdle to cross. It's so expensive, it's so impractical for so many schools that only reheat. So if they're only going to reheat, why not have big companies like Kraft, which makes Lunchables, decide they'll reformulate Lunchables so that they meet standards? What does this mean? Less saturated fat, but particularly less sodium. What they aren't doing yet is back formulating so that the stuff they sell in supermarkets has the same lower sodium level, because that's the national good that could come of their getting a piece of this lunch market.
Well, wait, did you just say this already? The good news is that it's healthier. The bad news is when you eat the healthier one, it isn't like the kid's going to say, I know that it's crap when I go to the supermarket, right?
Well, That's expecting a lot for a kid.
Right, exactly.
To say, withstand marketing and say, I never want to have candy. I've never looked at a TV commercial or social media push in my life. No, what I'm saying is that what would be best is if companies like Kraft learn to reformulate Lunchables so that they have lower sodium in schools, why don't they just market all of their Lunchables across the country with lower sodium so that when kids get them at home, it's the
exactly
same sodium product.
But I'm saying as long as there is that differential, that essentially it's like a bait and switch operation. The good news is they're getting the good thing, but they're being introduced to the bad thing through the back door at the schoolhouse. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, but the fact is once kids get used to eating something like a bunch of Lunchables that are lower sodium, they won't complain about them. And with luck, they'll say to their
parents, maybe that's
parents,
right. That's probably
why'd
right.
you buy
that's
this salty right. thing I hate?
You're probably right.
Okay, Corby Kummer, I must admit, I got this story from Mother Jones. Mother Jones is a great publication, but I'm really confused. On the one hand, it's saying that our planet is facing phosphageddon. In other words, we are running out of phosphorus, and there's no life on Earth without it, this professor tells Mother Jones. On the other hand, they're saying there are misuse of phosphorus, where we're over-fertilizing and the runoff from fields and lawns into rivers and lakes is choking those bodies of water with algae blooms and mm-hmm. killing fish, etc. So what is the point here? I'm not sure.
I guess if the article had been more clearly written or had more space, they could have made more points. The points being monoculture agriculture that require large inputs of phosphate in one place will often result in these water runoffs that have tremendous phosphates that create algal blooms that kill people, kill birds, kill wildlife.
Kill dogs.
Kill dogs. Yeah. See, there's something, you know, the death of one dog is a tragedy.
That's right.
So when it's getting dogs, it's something that we care about. But what's much more alarming is, yes, it's phosphorus is necessary for all farming, but that the U.S. reserves, because of the discovery of industrialized fertilizers at the end of the 1890s, are 1% of what they were. I don't know how long ago, but that the U.S. has basically no phosphorus, and it has to buy it from Morocco, the Western Sahara, China, and Algeria, which are the world's largest reserves of it. It's just amazing that America has stripped it was taken out of mountain ore and different stones, and it's exploited and stripped the U.S. of its natural reserves of phosphorus, and so it's got to rely on buying them. Britain, which I have no idea, has always had to rely on it because there's no reserves in Britain.
So we're running out of phosphorus, but phosphorus is polluting and ruining our streams and rivers and killing dogs. Okay.
So I would say smaller scale agriculture that requires less input of phosphorus will result in less pollution.
Okay, and we will have and feel less the shortage, Marjorie. That is the uniting of the two themes.
Or maybe we need a different sort of element besides phosphorus. I obviously know nothing about the chemistry of fertilizers, but
well, maybe you should learn.
If it's causing all that damage, maybe it's
it's adding nitrogen and phosphorus, and it's the Haber-Bosch process.
Whatever.
And there are great books about it, including The Wizard and the Prophet by Charles Mann. But I don't know what the substitutes for phosphorus are.
Okay, so I do understand this story in the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Champagne in Dixie Cups, Pancakes Flecked with Gold, Fine Dining Gets Fun Again. Fine dining, I have to say, not always, but often when I go to a fine dining experience, particularly with a long tasting menu, I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm afraid I'm not going to do the right thing. You got to act a certain way. It's not a comfortable feel to me. And apparently some of the great restaurateurs who converted to the tasting menu I didn't realize it was as recent as this, a couple of decades ago, have decided that the next move is away from the tasting menu and actually have an environment and food that is fun for the fine dining eater. Is that a fair summary of where the Wall Street Journal is going with this?
Well, clearly they read and you were subliminally influenced by my trend-setting Vanity Fair piece called ingredients for dinner, which was a big screed against tasting menus.
When was that again?
At the same history. It was 2 years before the pandemic.
I read it. It was right before the pandemic. That's correct. And what was the point you made exactly in that piece?
The Wall Street Journal has clearly read that piece and gone with it. The new point is restaurants have started abandoning this. You know, there's something cynical. First of all, the formality of those dinners where Jim is worried about which fork he's going to have and the
totally
rest
true.
Of us worried about how can we have the 35th fork in the same yard dinner? Let's not do this again. So great restaurants like Pineapple and Pearls in Washington, D.C. are still charging $345
that
a head.
Incredible.
Plus alcohol, but they're making it fun and they're keeping it to four courses. So it's much more humane. It's much more fun and casual. And the chef will take a seat right at your table and they wear funny cut velvet, colorful jackets and they have helium balloons at the top. And if it's your birthday, they'll make funfetti pancakes drizzled with maple syrup and flecked with 24 karat gold leaf for that $345 you're still paying. But you'll get out of there faster.
So you're making fun of this, is essentially what you're doing, this trend thing. The serious part, I think you are, the serious part of it that's good, when you said more humane, from what I understand, it's more humane to the staff than doing this 13 course. No, you're making a face at
me. No, I hope it's more humane to the staff.
Okay.
I hope that it is less demanding for the staff. And, you know, part of the idea is, part of the idea of the sacred chef who was sending out the 32 courses and was an international god like Ferran Adrià at El Bulli in Spain or Thomas Keller here at Per Se in French Laundry is that they are, you know, the complete dictator. And the recent popular culture version of that is it Ralph Fiennes who was in The Chef and plays this chef who winds up taking revenge on all of his pretentious...
The menu is what someone said.
The menu.
That was
the
John, correct? John Parker, of course. Thank you. Go ahead.
Wind up being themselves served for dinner.
Oh, that's so pretty good. Is,
oh!
You know, it was...
Thank
this
you, Margaret.
Ralph Fiennes is on the is in a platter on the table? Wow.
No. The diners get served.
The diners get served?
The staff and the chefs are taking their revenge on pretentious, super rich...
And they kill the customers and eat them for dinner?
Gotta eat.
I don't know.
In this case, what you hope is that if the restaurant's charging a fortune, first of all, it's so hard to find staff. It's so hard to pay them a decent living wage. Let's hope that they are doing that with these very, very high rates they're charging. But let's hope the whole idea of fun is not only in the dining room with the helium balloons, but in the kitchen itself, and that everyone is being treated more casually and in a more fun way.
Now, I have one last question, Corby, before you leave.
When you go
out for your $345 dinner, are they making sure that the chickens they buy and the meat they serve you are from well-sourced farms, or are we just getting the same old diseased chickens?
No, I can say that that has long been a part of very expensive restaurants.
Good.
They brag about their suppliers. You know, when it began as with Thomas Keller and sheep in northwestern Pennsylvania at a farm I can't remember the name of, we're the only place in the United States, come to California for your Pennsylvania sheep, Jameson Farms, I think. We're the only people getting this. So then it was what was super special. But I think that animal welfare became a big part of the selling point. The reason I'm saying this with a sort of asterisk is, who checked to see that really they were buying everything from those places? But it did become part of the line that they were selling customers.
Okay, two last quick questions because we're short on time. You always list, everybody who has your skills lists, you know, this place in Amsterdam, that place in Paris, this place in New York, that's a $350, you know, 27. What's that place in Boston? What is that place in Boston?
That place used to be L'Espalier and then became Menton, and Menton still exists.
Yeah.
So Menton, I think, is the highest priced of them because it wants diners to have a beautiful special occasion experience.
Okay, fair enough. Last thing for you, Corby, you are emceeing a dinner for a fabulous cause. Share Our Strengths, No Kid Hungry, Boston Dinner on Tuesday, March 28th. If people, Corby's going to tell you about the organization and the dinner very quickly, but if you want to find out about and maybe contribute to a wonderful organization and cause, it's nokidhungry.org. Tell us what they're doing and what you're doing, Corby.
So Sharon Strength and its fabulous founder, Billy Shore, who lives in Boston, Washington. Billy Shore is right here. And he's an incredible visionary guy who's just charmed the money off the trees. Why? Because he feeds hungry kids. And he's been doing this for decades. He's the national leader in this. They haven't done a Boston benefit since before the pandemic. I get to MC it. And, you know, Jim and Marjorie, you're both invited, even though you're not MCs.
So you don't have to come.
But there's going to be great, great chefs there cooking. And there's the humanitarian award going to the New Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund, the No Kid Hungry Chef Champion, the great Douglas Williams. I've never met Douglas Williams.
We've had him on. He's great. And a
Douglas
great place,
Williams,
too.
I know you have. And then a community champion, James O. Morton, who I bet has been on your show.
From the Y.
But the chefs are incredible. So it's Cassie Puma from Sarma. It's our favorite, Joanne Chang for dessert for Myers and Chang. John DeSilva from Chickadee. Colin Lynch from Bar Mezzana, which I go to all the time in Boston. So it's great chefs. It's expensive and it's worth it. I'm sure that there are still seats for next Tuesday night. But just go to ShareAStrengthNoKidHungry.org and see what they do to help feed hungry kids. It'll give you ideas of how you want to help in your own community.
And good for you for doing the work you do. Corby, it's great to see you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Corby. We've been speaking with Corby Kummer, Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Coming up, when you need something new, do you like shiny brand new, or do you, like thousands of your neighbors, turn to buy nothing exchange groups online? I'm going to open the lines up next at 877-301-8970 to talk about these buy nothing exchanges. Maybe you've tried them. Maybe you just want to hear about them. Maybe you've gotten some great deals and you can detail those to us. 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're Friday at the Boston Public Library with the Attorney General. By the way, we've really screwed up the time today, so we have very little time. So please, if you're interested in this, call us or text us quickly. The adage, one man's trash is another man's treasure, is fueling an explosion of online trade networks in your neighborhood. I'm talking about the Buy Nothing movement on Facebook. There was a story in the Globe we were talking about earlier today with Shirley Leung. Your town likely has its own, where your neighbors are offering up their finest family heirlooms. They just don't want any more. And things that are not even close to their finest family heirlooms. The pandemic fueled the rise in these groups. In East Boston, for example, the Buy Nothing group has doubled in size since May of 21. The one in Worcester added 1,500 people last year. Cambridge now has five groups, according to the Globe, after the city's original two got too large. So are you a prolific buy-nothinger? We'd love to hear from people who are actually part of this movement on Facebook. Do you use it to get new clothes, furniture, books, a dead hamster in a bag, which I still don't understand? And is it the sustainability and anti-consumerism aspect of it that draws you, maybe the community thing? Or are you just not into this thing at all? 877-301-8970. You do this kind of, do you like a trading kind of swapping kind of thing?
My oldest daughter does.
She does?
Yeah, they have all these.
She does?
Baby clothes, baby paraphernalia.
Because she's got a 1-year-old, 16-month-old kid.
Yeah, and hasn't bought lots of things.
Like
little rockers, people have done it with cribs, which are really expensive, strollers, which are really expensive. So you can do all that stuff. I haven't done it. Have you done it?
Yes, I do. I haven't bought anything in like years. And I'd like the part that is hard to me, Shirley Leung, who we discussed this with, suggested this. I mean, the part that's hard is you got to formally list things. And then if you list things, you end up sort of in competition. I know it's a community-based kind of thing, but if 11 people want the same thing, the person who's given up the heirloom family, whatever, or the diapers has to choose, right? Which I sort of... don't like. Having said that, I totally get it. There's 7 million people. Did I just say that? No. 7 million people nationwide who are part of this Facebook-based movement, and it's growing. It's called the Buy Nothing thing. We don't know if you're part of it, what you think about it, and if you're not part of it, is it something that has appeal to you?
A lot of people don't like Facebook anymore.
I know. That's an issue with this, by the way.
And they're trying to have a separate site, but so far it's not picked up as many people as Facebook has because so many people are on Facebook. I hear more and more people getting off both Facebook and Twitter.
Do you get – I know. But are you okay with things – that are used, I mean, as they say, lightly soiled. As long as something's in decent shape, you okay if it's not new? I'm totally fine with that. I don't.
Yeah. Well, something that is going to cost you a lot of money that you can get reduced price, absolutely.
Well, even if it's not going to cost you a lot, you're a huge environmentalist. I mean, it's your most important.
Well, I'm not a huge
environmentalist. No, but it's the issue I would argue you care most about.
Well, I may be talking the talk, Jim. I'm trying to walk the walk.
Well, isn't that a big part of this? I mentioned the anti-consumerism. I should have said it's also reuse is a huge pro-environment kind of thing.
A lot of this I think many of us are just ignorant about. I mean, this disposable clothing they sell at certain retailers.
It's not disposable.
It's disposable in the sense that it doesn't last. So you buy this really cheap clothing that's made in Vietnam and stuff like that.
No, but I meant not recyclable.
It's not recyclable, but then you find that it doesn't last, and then you end up throwing it out. I've now learned you're not supposed to throw textiles out, but I think people were doing that previously. But who even knew?
Who knew?
You were supporting this terrible kind of... planned, not even obsolescence, because if your shirt only lasts for 2 months, you can't really say it's obsolete, can you?
No, you can't.
It just falls apart.
Okay, fine. Jennifer in Rhode Island. What's she talking about? Jennifer in Rhode Island, you're next on Boston.
Talking about the store where I used to buy my kids' clothing.
Where was that?
The kids' store with the cheap clothes, right?
Jennifer in Rhode Island, you're next on Boston Public Radio.
Old lady,
you're first,
Jim,
or whatever
lady.
You are. Hi. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been a member of our local Little Compton Sheraton Buy Nothing for over a year or so, and I originally got on through Facebook friends thinking, oh, I'm going to find some really neat stuff. And all this stuff would come up, and you instant message the person so you can get their address, you go to their house, and you get 3 teacups, you know, as opposed to a set of 4 or 6, and you bring them home, and they go in the back of the cupboard, you know, and you never use them because they don't match anything else. So after that, a couple of times, I thought, okay, this is not working for me. But then I looked around my house and thought, I have a lot of stuff that's still working, that does match, that I don't use anymore. And I have found that to be a satisfying thing because I don't want to take the stuff to the dump. It's good enough to be reused. I've let go of a couple of chairs I lugged here from Pennsylvania, and people were delighted to have them. Some throwaway things in decent condition that people starting out a home were really happy.
Well, that's a great idea,
great.
Jennifer. You live in a beautiful place.
Oh my God,
in
I was just
Compton.
There for the first time a couple of months ago. Wow,
it's gorgeous there.
Hey, Jennifer, that was a great start. Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
That's worthwhile, what Jennifer's talking about, right? Giving away stuff that's used, that people can use in their home, like furniture. Yeah, but they have all these great secondhand furniture places, though. They have some great ones in Jamaica Plain.
They do?
Yes, I bought a lot of stuff there.
What have you bought there?
Bureaus.
You have?
Mirrors.
For yourself?
Yeah, for my
house.
No,
you haven't.
I have, absolutely. They're really gorgeous.
Raise your right
made.
Hand and say that. Oh, you did raise your right hand.
I
wow.
have several of them, actually. Phil in Danvers.
Hi,
Phil
in Danvers. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Boy, this is my lucky. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is my lucky week. I was on the other day on pet. I have the little Shih Tzu that I take to McDonald's.
Oh, I remember you.
Yes.
Hi there. Hi. Yeah.
We're never going to let this happen again, Phil. So enjoy it while it lasts.
He just had his suntan out in the backyard. But
fabulous.
Anyway,
what's up, Phil?
I moved a couple months ago, and I grew up in the house. So 68 years, all the stuff I had. So there was so much I wanted to get rid of, but I didn't have the time to have people come in, negotiate price. You know, it wasn't really, it was worth under $50 or whatever, even like furniture. So I put it on Facebook Marketplace free, and it was incredible how many people and how fast the stuff went. I didn't have to have them come in my house. I said, what time can you pick it up? And if they said 3 o'clock, it was outside. And if I checked 4 o'clock outside, it was gone. You know, there was tons of stuff I got rid of, and it really, really helped me.
Phil, that's a fabulous story. We're glad you called us again. Thank you much. Now, this is going to make me feel good. Zoe, our colleague, says, I sometimes pilfer the JP boomerangs for used CDs. Just got it all. Flogging Molly CD for like 99 cents. I play in my car. Boomerangs is great.
Boomerangs is great. I bought tons of stuff there.
Glasses, furniture, clothing. This is not to brag. This is just the state. I was talking to Shirley before. Am I still doing the Marie Kondo thing? I'm raising my right hand. In the last 2 months, I've taken approximately 100 bags to the Central Square boomerangs. And I assume I get a little bit of credit for being a
buyer.
Mostly clothing. Yeah. Because, kind of, you know, the kids are now grown and they finally get whatever. But so that sort of counts as being part of this anti-consumerism.
You're just not
doing
it online. You're doing it in the old-fashioned way. Actually taking your stuff to boomerangs yourself.
Thank you.
Listen to this from Wiley and Wellesley.
I feel much better now.
I've personally given or accepted mugs, food, tools, vitamins, cooking equipment, bedding, baby toys, coffee makers, clothing, decorative items, throw pillows, furniture, candles, books, puzzles, and more.
That's a long list there.
How about that? Oh, here's Jess from Denham. I think I know who this is, saying that my daughter, because she knows my daughter, does buy the Buy Nothing group, and we could still, still could not afford those nosebleed tickets to go to Bruce Springsteen. Glad Jim enjoyed the show. Jess.
It got
in
worse
Denham.
Than that, Jess, so we're not going to talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'll call you later to tell you the true story.
Sarah and Rockport.
Disgraceful.
Sarah and Rockport, you're next on Boston Public Radio. You've got a minute, Sarah. Thank you for calling. Hi.
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 Hi. Hi. I like Phil, I was very successful in putting two big furniture items on Facebook Marketplace.
Uh-huh.
So just my – and your concern, Jim, you just do first come, first serve. The first person that responds to you.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, that's easy.
Sense.
And
yep.
I had no issue. The biggest thing that I was so delighted, I had a 1970 – you know, my kids grew up in the 70s, 60s, 70s – a World Book Encyclopedia that I could not throw out. I went to my local dump. No, they weren't going to take them. Nobody was going to take them. I put them on Facebook Marketplace, and some woman came and got them. And my kid said, "What in the world did she want them
exactly
for?"
What's the answer?
You know, yeah. So I texted her, and she said, "I want to show my children how to use a reference book." And so she said, "I have a young child." That was the most delightful thing, to get rid of my complete set of World Book Encyclopedias plus the two dictionaries. So it's very successful.
That is very sad. By the way, I didn't even do that, and I feel satisfied. That is a very satisfying story, Sarah, and another wonderful use of this Buy Nothing forum. Sarah, thanks.
My 15-year-old daughter has been selling her clothes that she grows out of for a few years on Mercari, Mercari. She's made over $1,000, and it gives her a sense of accomplishment. She has a 5-star review from her customers, and then she turns around and buys all her quote-unquote designer and vintage clothes at secondhand stores.
That's a lovely story
in
the day.
I was very impressed. She's a little entrepreneur at an early age.
Okay, bye.
Oh, my goodness.
Show's
done.
Over. Yeah.
The show is over.
That's the way it works.
Okay, thank you very much for tuning in today. We really appreciate it. Do you want to say we're going to be at the library on Friday, Jim?
Library on Friday. Who's going to be there again? I can't remember.
Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, yeah. Andrea Campbell. I don't think we've had her on as the AG, have
we? Yes, we have.
We have? Okay. Yeah. Oops, we had her on before as the AG. Okay.
You meant we haven't had her on a lot as the AG. Is that what you're trying to say?
As the AG, okay. But she'll be there on Friday as the AG.
Not for the first time.
Yeah. That is correct. Okay. Tune in tomorrow for NBC's Chuck Todd, former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral.
Richard Blanco was one of the people with Springsteen and Huey Louis Dreyfus who got a National Humanities Medal from Biden yesterday, and no one tells us this?
I saw the story. I didn't see
it. We just got a text.
There.
Maine poet and author Richard Blanco receives a National Humanities Medal.
Mindy Kaling.
Blanco and others were honored by President Biden during a ceremony at the White House.
Well, gee, pay attention, Jim.
Jesus.
Pick up your game.
You didn't know he's...
I read the whole
that
story.
That is huge. Richard,
they
if you're
didn't
listening.
Put him in the story. That's
terrible. Huge.
That is huge.
My God.
Okay, we'll congratulate him next time he's on. Mother had to finish. She was
I'm sorry.
Tomorrow.
I got all upset. We didn't know about this.
Marcela Garcia, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
God.
We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss, our engineer John LaClaw Parker. Our executive producer is Jenny Bologna. Jim Browdy is not paying attention at all over there.
Oh, what am I supposed to say? What'd you say? I'm looking at the picture of Richard shaking President Biden's hand.
Okay, thank you very much for tuning in today. Hope you can tune in tomorrow. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Bye.